Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And a damning report by the New York City Department of Investigation has found that the New York City Housing Authority, which oversees roughly 180,000 apartments, hasn't inspected those apartments for lead paint in 4 years, despite claiming to do so. The report says NYCHA chairwoman Shola Olatoye had signed off on papers confirming the inspections anyway, even after knowing the inspections weren't happening, which of course would be in violation of local and federal law, as well as just wrong. The issue has been under investigation by the Fed since last year, apparently. And after the news broke about false reports related to lead paint inspections, two senior officials have resigned, while a third NYCHA official was demoted and suspended. And now the Daily News reports that Mayor de Blasio also knew for more than a year that NYCHA wasn't performing lead inspections after Chairwoman Olatoye reported it to him. Joining us now to tell us more about the investigation is City Council Member Richie Torres, who represents District 15, which includes the Central Bronx. And he's also on the City Council Committee on Public Housing. Councilman Torres, welcome back to WNYC.
It's an honor to be here, Brian.
Can you tell us first your understanding about what Mayor de Blasio knew and when he knew it?
Well, my understanding is that when the chairperson found out that the Housing Authority had been falsely certifying lead paint inspections, she brought it to the attention not only to the federal regulators, but also the mayor. But by the time the mayor found out, my understanding is that it was known to the federal government as well as to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
So I'm confused about NYCHA Chairwoman Shola Olatoye's role. Did she collude, to use a word of this year, in covering up the fact that inspections weren't being done but were being reported as done? Did she collude in it, or did she, when it came to her attention, blow the whistle on it?
It's a combination of both. So she did sign the false certification, but at the same time, when she became aware of the false certification, she did inform federal regulators. The question is, why did she inform federal regulators? Did she do it out of her own volition, or did she do it under pressure from an investigation from the U.S. Attorney's Office? It's worth noting that in addition to the DOI report, NYCHA is under investigation from the U.S. Attorney's Office regarding its noncompliance with federal law on lead paint inspections.
How much of an issue is lead paint in public housing at this point? People who've been around for a while and are hearing this might think, God, lead paint, that was from decades ago. I thought they already got that out of everywhere.
So I think it's important to preface these conversations with a disclaimer, right? There is no evidence of an epidemic of lead poisoning in public housing. Since 2010, there have only been 17 apartments where children have tested positive for hazardously high level of lead paint. So we have to be careful not to create a panic among residents in public housing and give the impression that there's a public health emergency. At the same time, there is evidence, as shown in the DOI report, that NYCHA has consistently lied to the federal government under oath about conducting lead paint inspections. In public housing, there are 55,000 apartments that are either known or presumed to have lead paint. NYCHA went 4 years certifying visual assessments in those 55,000 apartments that never actually underwent inspection. And so for me, the issue is not the problem of lead poisoning, which is negligible in public housing. The fundamental issue is a crisis of public confidence in the credibility of the housing authority. And the only hope for restoring public trust is an independent monitor, which I have called for.
And so does this generalize to trust in the housing authority in ways other than lead paint?
It could, especially on matters of public health, whether it be lead or mold. But by virtue of lying to the federal government for 4 years, NYCHA has shown that it cannot be fully trusted to conduct lead paint inspections without supervision, nor can it be trusted to report honestly on the results of those inspections. And so there's an indisputable need for a third-party monitor. Now, there's a distinct possibility that the investigation from the U.S. attorney could result in a settlement that imposes an independent monitor. So whether it comes from DOI or the state or the U.S. attorney, it seems to me that an independent monitor might be inevitable.
And listeners, if you want to call in from public housing or from anywhere else to talk to City Council Member Richie Torres from the Bronx, a member of the Committee on Public Housing, as we talk about this lead paint and lead paint misrepresentation, apparently, as to the status of it in many public housing units. What do you want to be done with any apartments that still have lead paint? I think public health experts decades ago landed on it's not best for the children who might get exposed to lead paint and have brain damage from it, et cetera. It's not best to go chopping up the walls and trying to remove all the paint. It's better to leave it unless it seems to be crumbling. Or what's your understanding as the best practice at this point?
So my understanding of the best practice and the requirements of the law is that NYCHA is supposed to inspect annually apartments that are either known or presumed to have lead paint. And then once those apartments become vacant, then you can do the deeper gut rehabilitations that could remove lead paint. But for the reasons that you stated earlier, it would be unwise to do so while there are children in the apartment, because children ages 6 or under are susceptible to neurological damage that can result from lead paint.
But that the inspections are important to make sure that the walls aren't starting to crumble, in which case exposure
Precisely.
Could happen even if it's been painted
yeah.
over.
If there's a chip that falls on a windowsill or a radiator and a child, not knowing better, ingest a chip of lead paint, then it can do real damage. That's why those inspections are critically important.
What's the role of the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development in this? Because according to the Department of Investigation report, the city stopped conducting annual inspections of apartments for general conditions after HUD relaxed its rules for doing so in 2012. Is that your understanding? And if so, is some of this on the Obama administration?
I mean, my understanding is that both federal law and local law requires annual inspections of apartments that are presumed or known to have lead paint, and that NYCHA was falsely certifying that it had actually conducted inspections that were never performed. So as far as I'm concerned, the burden of responsibility falls squarely on the shoulders of NYCHA.
Let's take a phone call. Eric in Williamsburg, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Doing this kind of quickly, I worked for a private corporation. I was in charge of tenant services for them, but was aware of the whole management thing. But managed several public housing run buildings that were at one time taken over by the city in REM, and they were in fairly bad condition. We had to fight very, very hard to get any services, to get them in fair condition. In some of the buildings, they did check for lead, and they did something where they closed off the building and did a lot of work. But the contractors, at one time we caught, they're sending in a contractor that was not fully licensed, for example. And they overcharged, they didn't do the work on schedule. At one point, I arranged a place to stay for a woman who had severe health problems and even rented a hospital bed for her. And they changed the date at the last minute. I think the Housing Authority was trying, without enough resources, to conduct what needed more resources. And there was a squeeze at all times on public housing. And the real crisis isn't a crisis in competence, but the fact that much of the staff that wanted to protect their own positions and had little sympathy with the residents in the projects thought they were running a privately owned corporation and were willing to squeeze resources down.
Oh, boy. Eric, thank you very much. How much of that are you aware of and do you agree with in terms of his interpretation of it, Councilman?
Well, I think the most striking part of his comment was the resource question. You know, it could be the case that NYCHA lacks the resources to conduct all the inspections required by federal law. And if that's true, then NYCHA should say so rather than lie to the federal government about conducting those inspections. Right? If NYCHA were to acknowledge that there are resource constraints, then the burden would fall on the city and state to ensure that those inspections could happen.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. The recommendations of the Ferguson Commission are being touted as a potential roadmap to move forward after this year's protests stemming from the not guilty verdict in the Jason Stockley trial. Some of the recommendations deal with predatory lending, which often traps low-income earners with very high-interest loans. As St. Louis Public Radio's Wayne Pratt reports, there is movement on the issue in Washington, D.C., Jefferson City, and St. Louis.
In its final report, the commission called for an end to predatory lending by, quote, changing repayment terms, underwriting standards, collection practices, and by capping the maximum annual percentage rate at 26%. Rates in Missouri on a two-week loan could be as high as 75%. Some local progress came earlier this year when St. Louis voters approved a ballot measure.
The aim of Proposition S was to take into the local municipal hands some of the regulation on payday lenders.
That is St. Louis 20th Ward Alderwoman Kara Spencer, who spearheaded the effort in support of Prop S.
It imposes a fine, which allows the city to actually fund regulation of the industry. But its uniqueness is that it also requires that lenders provide a list of alternatives to payday lenders to their customers.
Just outside Spencer's ward is this intersection of South Jefferson Avenue and Gravois. A quick look around and I see a beauty supply store, a fast food restaurant at a 7-Eleven, and just down on Gravois, a couple of payday lending operations back to back. Even though I'm in South City, this is a scene that is repeated throughout St. Louis. Some options for quick cash with interest rates noticeably higher than traditional banks and also quick access to the money. That recipe was originally attractive for Cedric Jones. He thought a payday loan just a few years ago would be a quick way to deal with some unexpected bills, but Jones says he was shocked by the high interest rates.
What I got was like about 1,000%. And it depends, you know, like if you get it on an installment plan, you know, it's really ridiculous. If you get it, you know, to pay it back the next payday, still, you know, an astronomically high interest rate.
Jones was living in St. Louis when the commission released its recommendations, and his story is featured on the Forward Through Ferguson website. He says more banking options for low-income earners would be an ideal alternative to payday loans.
Because most people who go get those loans simply do not have a bank account. And because they do not have access to conventional banking, they are forced to turn to those places. And they know that, so they take advantage of that.
The most significant action in Missouri will likely have to come from lawmakers in Jefferson City. That's where State Representative Charlie Davis comes in.
The Republican from Webb City is planning to reintroduce legislation next year that limits how often short-term lenders can renew loans. It also restricts how many payday loans a person can take out. But Davis's bill does not deal with interest rates.
On a very short-term loan, a week or 2 weeks, a high interest rate is irrelevant because you paint it off and you pay some extra money and you're done.
The issue is also a flashpoint in Washington, D.C. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was named an accountable body by the Ferguson Commission, essentially meaning it's at the forefront of coming up with ways to deal with predatory loans. Director Richard Cordray is stepping down at the end of the month, and as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reported last week, the Bureau could change course under expected replacement, Federal Budget Director Michael Mulvaney.
It would be a lot more friendly to banks and payday lenders. Mulvaney could stop the agency from finishing regulations it's in the midst of, slow down rules that haven't taken effect yet. One particular, the payday lending rule, has been very controversial.
That proposal would require lenders to make sure people actually have the ability to pay back the money. The Financial Service Centers of America trade group says the possible regulation would, quote, devastate the short-term loan industry. For St. Louis Public Radio, I'm Wayne Pratt.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
And this is KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Good morning. I'm Emily Fox. In 2014, Mayor Ed Murray ordered all city departments to apply a racial equity lens to their work. But it turns out some city departments never did that. Here to explain what's going on is KUOW's Patricia Murphy from our race and equity team. And walk us through this. What was the mayor's order?
The mayor ordered all city departments to consider race and equity when making decisions or working on city projects. And the way they were supposed to be doing this was by completing what's known as a racial equity toolkit. That is just a technical term for a process that could include things like examining input from neighbors impacted by a project. But it also includes a plan to avoid negative impacts, especially on communities of color. And when we looked into this, we found out that in 2015, 25% of departments did not comply with the mayor's order. And then we learned that in 2016, that number went up to 42%. So 42% of city departments just didn't do what the mayor asked.
And why do you think that is?
Well, it's hard to say. And if I had to sum up a ton of emails I read between Seattle Police and the Office of Civil Rights, I would say that everyone was always really cordial. And they always agreed that doing toolkits on things like micro policing or acoustic gunshot detection and the North Precinct were important. But then in the end, they never materialized. And when things played out that way, with SPD or another city department, the Office of Civil Rights really had no enforcement capability. They couldn't do anything about it.
So what's next?
Change is likely afoot for the Office of Civil Rights. There is a new mayor. And yesterday, the Seattle City Council took action that clears the way for the office to be reorganized. And the council started hearing concerns from civil rights staff about their ability to do their jobs back in September. So this is an action that originated back then.
So going back to 2014, why was there this need by Mayor Ed Murray for all departments to really focus on racial equity?
Well, the city's Race and Social Justice Initiative attempts to address structural racism and inequity. And those are really important problems, especially for Seattle, a city that's growing as quickly as this one is. But that being said, doing this kind of work doesn't come naturally for people. So really, the most important thing is that the city comes up with a way, an effective way, to get this work done.
KUOW's Patricia Murphy with our race and equity team. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
On these last 2 days leading up to Thanksgiving, the President of the United States handed out meals to underprivileged and calmly reflected on all of his blessings. Just kidding. He basically endorsed an accused child molester and called somebody's dad an ungrateful fool. I'm John Berman in for Anderson. We are thankful you've joined us tonight after what has been a notable day and a half in the Trump presidency. It started out pretty traditionally yesterday afternoon, the president dutifully performing this bit of pre-Thanksgiving shtick at the White House, pardoning two turkeys named Drumstick and Wishbone, The president did thank the military and first responders and called for a renewal of the bonds of trust and affection between citizens of America. Trust and affection, which didn't last until sunrise, because at 5:25 a.m., the president of the United States lashed out at LeVar Ball for not being grateful enough that he helped get his son and two other UCLA basketball players out of China after they were arrested for shoplifting. The president wrote, "It wasn't the White House, it wasn't the State Department, it wasn't Father LaValle's so-called people on the ground in China that got his son out of a long-term prison sentence. It was me." All caps, by the way. "Too bad. LaVar is just a poor man's version of Don King, but without the hair. Just think, LaVar, you could have spent the next 5 to 10 years during Thanksgiving with your son in China, but no NBA contract to support you. But remember, LaVar, shoplifting is not a little thing. It's a really big deal, especially in China. Ungrateful fool." You can just feel the trust and affection oozing everywhere. First, a little context here. These tweets were ostensibly in reaction to an interview LeVar Ball did on CNN Monday night with Chris Cuomo.
I have to know what somebody's doing before I say thank you. I'm just not going to go around saying thank you.
All right, so let's...
Now, you come and shake my hand and meet me or meet my son or anybody and then say, you know what, maybe I can help you out. Let's do it that way. But just because people say things, you know, it's supposed to be true, like, hey, I stopped him from saving 10 years. Maybe we was doing some talking with some other people before he even got there.
And let's not forget that a week ago today, LeVar Ball's son and the two other players all complied with the president's less than subtle request for gratitude.
To President Trump and the United States government, thank you for taking the time to intervene on our behalf.
Thank you to the United States government and President Trump for your efforts to bring us home.
I'd also like to thank President Trump and the United States government for the help that they provided as well.
So those thanks were not enough to satisfy the president's appetite, and here we are with this morning's tweets. Again, calling LeVar Ball an ungrateful fool, and curiously, the poor man's Don King without the hair. Curious first, because is that a hair joke? Seriously? And second, is there, in fact, a rich man's Don King in this scenario? The actual Don King was once convicted of manslaughter, then pardoned. He is a friend of the president's. He supported and appeared with him throughout the campaign, something it doesn't seem LeVar Ball would do. Or maybe, just maybe, this is about more than hair. Were there messages in what the president said, how he said it, and the target? We will discuss that. Keeping them honest, some say this president is a master of distraction, that he goes on these types of tirades when the Russia investigation seems like it's closing in or to distract from something else he said that's getting him unflattering press, something like this, perhaps.
Mr. President, is an accused child molester better than a Democrat? Is an accused
Well, he denies it. Look, he denies it. I mean, if you look at what is really going on and you look at all the things that have happened over the last 48 hours, he totally denies it. He says it didn't happen.
The president coming out in support of Roy Moore, accused of molesting a 14-year-old girl. No name calling, no Twitter tirade, no criticism. Just support. That was yesterday afternoon, right after the president pardoned those turkeys. Drumstick and Wishbone are now living comfortably on a Virginia farm. We hope they displayed their gratitude in a way that was satisfying to the president, else he might make fun of their hair. Lots to talk about tonight. Joining us now, two CNN political commentators, former South Carolina State House member Bakari Sellers and Paris Denard, former White House Director of Black Outreach for President George W. Bush. Thank you both for being here. I give thanks for your presence constantly. Bakari, I want to start with you. Do you believe that there is any racial overtone to the president's tweets, or is this just two self-promoters going at it on Twitter?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. But first, I think it's necessary for all of us to take a step back and judge this based on what it should be judged based upon. I mean, a year ago, you had the president of the United States, you had the 44th president of the United States, what he did on Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I'm meaning Barack Obama.
Damn you, Obama.
He was actually going to homeless shelters, feeding homeless veterans in Washington, D.C. That's how he spent his Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And now we have the president of the United States chastising yet another foil, which happens to be African-American. And so to answer your question directly, it's yes. The president, he draws this sense of inevitability. He patronizes, he delves into these issues of racism all the time. And the reason he does it is because of the fact that he gets something out of this. He builds his currency from racism and cultural divisiveness. And so, yes, his foils are the media, his foils are the establishment, but his foils are also black people, which is why we see him go after the Jameel Hills, the Steph Currys, the LeVar Balls, the Marshawn Lynches, the NFL players. The list goes on and on and on. But I think you and everyone else should take a step back and look at what a president should be and look at what Donald Trump is. We had a president who was feeding the homeless, taking care of veterans a year ago, and now we have Donald Trump.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Some major changes may be coming to how the U.S. government collects data about who we are. The Trump administration is looking at proposals to ask about race and ethnicity in a radical new way on the census and in other surveys. A decision is expected by December, and that timing is raising concerns among some immigrants and communities of color. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang has our report.
Once a decade, the U.S. government asks us to fit our racial and ethnic identities into a box for the census.
Do you remember what box you checked?
I don't feel mixed, so I always fill out white, Caucasian.
I put down Negro.
I identify as both black and white.
That was Jennifer Brown from the Bronx, Frankie Weish of Brooklyn, and Angelique Mativier of Meriden, Connecticut. Mativier says she's been checking off two boxes, both black and white, ever since the Census Bureau first allowed it back in 2000. But if she had it her way, she'd check off even more boxes to reflect her ethnic identities.
What about the fact that my family is also French-Canadian, Portuguese, you know? If we're going to talk about it, let's talk about the cultural and the ethnic aspects that we have instead of just color.
That's a change that may be coming with the 2020 census and other surveys that follow standards set by the White House for how federal agencies collect race and ethnicity data. Those rules say that whenever people are asked to self-report, they must be presented with two questions. First, are you of Hispanic or Latino origin? Then, what is your race?
People were pretty secure in how they filled out the Hispanic question.
Tomas Jimenez, a sociologist at Stanford University, has studied how Latinos have filled out the census.
But then when they got down to the race question, and there's a set of options that lay out other ethnic groups and they don't see their own, they're just more or less confused.
Those options for race on the last census, back in 2010, ranged from broad racial groups, like white and African American, to ethnic groups, like Filipino and Samoan. Many Latinos checked off some other race. In fact, that was the third largest racial group in 2000 and 2010. So the Census Bureau has recommended combining the two questions into one, with Hispanic or Latino as an option for both race and ethnicity in 2020. But that proposal has raised a question about Hispanic people who in the past have checked off white for their race. Will they keep doing so if Hispanic is categorized as both a race and an ethnicity?
That's going to basically chip away in some sense at the official counts of the white population, and that would fuel some of the anxieties that are behind the white supremacist movement.
Anne Morning is a sociologist at New York University who advises the Census Bureau on race and ethnicity issues. She points to the Bureau's research that suggests combining the Hispanic origin and race questions could lead to a smaller white count in 2020. There's another group that, for the most part, has identified as white on the census, but may break away in 2020 if the White House approves a separate proposal.
Some of us identify as white. Some of us identify as brown, black.
Helen Simhan is a co-founder of the Arab American Institute. And since the early 1990s, she's been campaigning for a new category for people of Middle Eastern or North African descent.
It was really based on concerns that we had about our invisibility. And now, fast forward 25, 30 years, and it feels like there's a hypervisibility of our community. So it's really a double-edged sword.
The Census Bureau is not allowed to release any data identifying an individual. But Simhan says she's worried about what the Trump administration could do with data about specific populations for surveillance and other counterterrorism efforts. The White House is expected to announce a decision on these proposals by December 1st. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, New York.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, or a combination of all three. before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That's it. Anywhere on the planet you are.
How far would you go to protect your family? Tonight, in a story you'll only see on 11 Alive, our investigators reveal a grandfather's fantasy to kill his own son to gain custody of his granddaughter. Making this even more chilling, he's got a badge and a gun. And as 11 Alive Chief Investigator Brendan Keefe explains, a new Georgia law is playing right into all of this.
This little girl has a lot of people who love her.
So pretty.
Her father, Brandon Roberts.
When I held her the first time, everything changed. I knew I'd do anything to protect her.
And her grandfather, Dale Roberts.
From the day she was born, I promised her I would always be there to love and protect her. This is a dollhouse that I started building for my granddaughter February of last year. I just hope she gets to play with it one day.
We advised him that he could come see her at our house, but we did not feel safe with her going over there by herself anymore.
What happened, baby? Mommy and Daddy will not let you go if you're scared.
Brandon says his father had become obsessed with his daughter and cut off contact. The grandfather responded
that he was going to do everything in his power to ruin us.
And he put that in writing.
He did, in a text.
The pain and hurt you've caused me by keeping my granddaughter away from me, I'm going to do everything within my power to ruin you both. Did you write that?
Yes, sir, I did.
What do you have to say about that?
It was said in anger. I wanted my granddaughter back, and they took basically what I lived for.
I believe he wanted my family to be unstable so he could show the court that we were unstable, so in order for him to get custody.
That rocking chair, I don't know how many hours we spent in that chair together. All I could do is sit there and cry because I didn't know if I'd see her again.
Dale sued his own son under Georgia's new grandparents' rights law. That's how Brandon got a copy of his father's private journal through discovery.
Brandon is a sorry son of a bitch who is an uncaring bitch. He is no longer my son. I hate him so much now. I wish he were dead.
Do you wish your son was dead?
Not really. I was speaking out in anger. And I hated my son. I really hated him for what he'd done.
What does your father do for a living?
He is a Georgia State Trooper.
Trooper Dale Roberts of the Georgia State Patrol wrote something else in his journal about his son.
I hate Brandon so bad I could put a bullet between his eyes and not blink.
The state gave you a gun and trained you how to use it, and here you are writing down, I want to put a bullet in my son's head.
These words were spoken or written in anger. There's been plenty of words written in anger since this situation began.
You don't want to hurt your son.
No, sir, I did not want to hurt my son.
And he told the court that the journal was full of his love for my daughter, when in fact he was writing stuff about killing her father.
Still, a Spalding County judge ruled in favor of the grandfather, ordering Brandon to hand over his daughter to Dale 2 full weeks in the summer, most holidays, and 2 weekends every month.
It was a parent's visitation that he got. He got more than the biological mother originally got for visitation.
A parent can sue their own estranged child to get essentially shared custody of the grandchild.
As a step-parent, even if I were to adopt, he would still have more rights than I would. Which is crazy.
You felt boxed in, and you felt you had only one choice.
To move.
To leave the state.
To leave the state.
Stephanie and Brandon packed the kids in the car and drove, leaving Georgia and Dale in their rearview mirror. They crossed the Iowa border and kept driving deep into the rural heartland.
Did you pick this place because you knew it would be hard to find?
Yes. Or we figured it would be hard to find.
Well, where is Mommy and Daddy?
They were hiding out. Quite literally in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by Iowa bean and cornfields, no one for miles around. But somehow Trooper Roberts tracked them down.
I hired 2 private investigators.
Sheriff's deputies here in Iowa were asked to serve Brandon with papers for contempt of court, the attorney letter clearly stating that his client was a trooper in the Georgia State Patrol.
I answered the door, and the cop was very aggressive.
He drew his taser on me.
Do you think that had anything to do with the fact that they were told in advance that your father was a Georgia State Patrol trooper?
I believe it was because he called them.
Did you ever mention to the sheriff's office up there that you're a Georgia State Patrol trooper?
Yes, sir.
Why would you mention your job to another law enforcement officer if it doesn't have anything to do with a civil case?
It's just person's preference, the way law enforcement people are. We mingle, and I go to a lot of funerals for troopers that's been killed out of state, and you know, we introduce, it's just professional courtesy.
And Roberts versus Roberts.
Back in a Georgia courtroom.
So, Judge, we would ask that you enter an order finding him in contempt, ordering that he be incarcerated.
The grandfather showed up, but his son did not.
Shooting somebody in the head, threatening to kill or murder his son and his son's wife in order to get custody, I might have moved to Alaska if it had been me.
Trooper Roberts came with a new piece of evidence.
I took my daughter for my family's safety, and we moved to Iowa because you threatened to kill us like a piece of shit cop you are.
A voicemail left by his son.
The NAACP is going to read what you put in that journal about niggers, and I cannot wait till the day your ass goes downhill for what you've done. Racist pig.
He was referencing another line from his father's journal.
When I take the car from him, I'm going to sell it. Going to have it professionally cleaned, though. It looks like a bunch of lived in it.
There's a word scribbled out there. Do you know what that word was?
No, sir. Idiots. No.
There appear to be two G's in the middle of the scribble.
I know where you're going, but no, sir.
That's not the N-word.
No, sir, it's not. It could be an idiots. Could. I don't know, but it is not that word.
Do you use that word?
No, I do not.
The trooper later admitted to us in writing it was the N-word.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
That's not the N-word.
No, sir, it's not. It could be an idiot. I don't know, but it is not that word.
Do you use that word?
No, I do not.
The trooper later admitted to us in writing it was the N-word. He says he scribbled it out so his granddaughter wouldn't see her poppy as a racist.
I'm not perfect, never have been perfect. I'm probably one of the farthest people from ever being perfect. But if I'm perfect in anything, it was being a grandfather to my granddaughter.
And now Trooper Roberts is suing for full custody of his granddaughter. Brandon Roberts has filed a motion to take the custody case out of Georgia because both biological parents now live out of state. So Georgia would not have jurisdiction.
All right. Is it possible that the grandfather could get custody here?
Well, no one thought that the grandfather could get essentially shared custody in this case. But the judge ruled that because there was this pre-existing relationship. He had taken care of the girl when she was 1 and 2 years old. So obviously anything can happen. As you know, a lawyer yourself, a judge can order just about anything.
Now, the relationship between father and son obviously broken. How's that little girl doing? And does she have any idea what's going on here?
Yeah, fortunately, no. I mean, she was 3 years old when this started. She's now 4. She's starting to remember a few things. These custody things are always difficult because it's always hard to see just who is on the side of the angels. By the way, the judge did order that Brandon be put in jail and that he turn her over for 40 days to his grandfather.
Has that happened?
To his father, rather. And that has not happened because right now there is a stay pending appeal.
All right. Well, I'm sure we're going to continue to follow this. I mean, it's a bizarre twist, but it's Georgia's law that is in the middle of all this.
It is. And then one of them is a lawman in a very small circuit down there in Griffin.
All right. Yeah. Great job. Thanks so much, buddy.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Controversies involving race and professional sports have grabbed national headlines in recent months, but the issue is playing out in high school athletics, too. 90.5 WESA is exploring the issue. Government and law reporter Ann Lee Herring and education reporter Sarah Schneider take stock of the situation in the Pittsburgh region.
I'm Sarah Schneider, and this story, it started with a sign. It meant different things to different people. Some say it was racially charged. Others say it was just a clever play on words meant to rally a crowd.
And I'm Ann Lee Herring. The sign said Trump Perry. The president's recognizable hair was drawn above the big bold letters, which were followed by a large image of the American flag. Students from Brooke High School in West Virginia say they made the sign for a red, white, and blue-themed football game September 22nd against Pittsburgh's Perry High School. They say they used the president's name simply because it means to beat or defeat.
But for many visitors from Perry, where more than 75% of students are black, the sign was racially insensitive and even intimidating. Behind it, the stands were filled with white students. Brooke is 97% white. And it invoked the name of a president who many believe has emboldened white supremacist groups.
That same night, President Trump had also started to criticize NFL players for protesting the treatment of people of color by law enforcement.
But we're not only talking about a sign. This is just one example of something that happens regularly in high school athletics. It's not a new issue, but athletes, coaches, parents, and administrators say they continue to struggle with it.
It's something that's happening across the country, on the gridiron, on the basketball court, and on the soccer field, which is where we go now. Members of the soccer team at Pittsburgh's Obama Academy in East Liberty say they often encounter racially charged behavior on the field. Over 70% of students at Obama are black, and the school's teams are some of the most diverse in the region. 15-year-old Brandon Sears started playing soccer for Obama this fall, and he remembers the first time an opposing player called him the N-word.
I was shocked, but then again I wasn't, because knowing that I'm black and he's white, something happens.
Sears was tempted to fight, but he didn't. He followed the advice he got at the beginning of the season in a discussion that has become custom for his team, according to assistant coach Christopher Thyberg.
Usually, like, the only thing that we can do is ask the players to try to be the bigger person, which is a very unfair request to tell them, hey, you're going to get racially abused, but you have to, you know, not respond to it.
The captain of Obama's soccer team, 17-year-old Ian Thomas, who is white, says his teammates of color are targeted both verbally and physically.
What would happen is the kid starts talking. He starts talking in his ear. We're in a corner kick, like at the very beginning of the game, and then it just, that kind of ramps up. It gets more and more intense as the game goes on. Elbows are being thrown. Kids are, like, stomping. Like, they're cleating each other intentionally, tripping each other.
Thomas acknowledges that it's the nature of competition to take some cheap shots to get into your opponent's head. But something about race, his instincts tell him, crosses the line.
You get on the field, your mindset changes, you get a little more tense, and it gets aggressive. But, like, I question if it would be different with my players of color that are on the team. Like, would they be so kind to them outside of the field as they might be to me?
When Thomas's teammate Sears was first called a slur by another player, he was angry and used music to try to stay motivated for his next game. Though he'd rather forget about the whole issue, he says it still bothers him.
I'm not a regular person.
It does happen a lot. And that's the sad part about it. Like, you're not there to call people names. You're there to compete.
Larry Davis, dean of Pitt School of Social Work, shares Brandon's sadness. Also black, Davis has devoted his career to the study of race and social justice.
I'm disappointed that race hasn't sports haven't seemed to help race relations very much.
Davis says that race has always been an issue for black athletes in the U.S. For example, when the black heavyweight champion Jack Johnson defeated white boxer Jim Jeffries in what was dubbed the fight of the century in 1910, race riots broke out all across the country. And when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record in 1974, he received thousands of death threats. Davis says the performance of black athletes has long threatened white masculinity.
It's for sort of dominance of who is the better group. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but that's kind of what it's about.
Yet Davis suggests that race relations might actually be worse if it weren't for sports and its ability to facilitate interaction across races. Coach Thyberg recalls a game where one of Obama's white players joked that a foul against a teammate of color must have been racially motivated. Another player on the bench, Thyberg says, made it a teachable moment.
He wasn't rude or mean-spirited, but he called him out on it and said, "Why is that funny to you?" And had this exchange where he was able to say, like, it's not funny when this is happening to me on the field. After that, I didn't see it happen again.
According to Thyberg and members of Obama's soccer team, they're more likely to encounter problems when they play teams outside the city. Obama is one of about 140 teams in the Western Pennsylvania Interscholastic Athletic League, or WIPIAL. The WPIAL spans 9 counties and includes schools as far away as Laurel Highlands, Leechburg, and Newcastle. This fall, the league was forced to confront the issue of race after a football game between 2 distant schools. Elwood City's Lincoln High School had traveled from a rural district that is over 90% white to play Valley High School, one of the WPIAL's most diverse teams. With less than 2 minutes remaining, the game erupted into a bench-clearing brawl. Valley's coach and superintendent say their athletes were provoked because players from Lincoln had been calling them racial slurs throughout the game. The resulting controversy and a rise in unsportsmanlike behavior in general prompted the WPIAL to send a letter condemning the trend to all of its member schools in early October. The letter noted that reports of racially insensitive comments had become all too common.
Kids think it's appropriate to trash talk. And unless somebody tells them that this is inappropriate, they're going to keep doing it.
That's WPIAL Executive Director Tim O'Malley. He says educators and families must take the lead in correcting this behavior.
How do you put an end to it? I think from an educational standpoint, there's a responsibility to try to continue to work with the kids in your schools, with your children, to make sure that they understand what is and isn't acceptable.
So how do schools fulfill this responsibility? Where do parents and administrators come in? Tomorrow, we'll go from the field to the schools and board meetings where adults are trying to manage the fallout from these incidents. I'm Sarah Schneider.
And I'm Anlee Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
A middle school student in Randolph County says a trip to the principal's office earlier this fall turned into a violent arrest that left her with injuries to her face. She says officers pushed her against a wall, then down on the ground, pressing a knee into her back. Reporter Jordan Green heard about Consuela Batista's arrest and decided to look into her story. He also dug into other juvenile complaints filed in Randolph County, and he found that while African-American youth like Consuela make up less than 4% of the student population in that area, they account for more than a quarter of the filed juvenile complaints. He's here to talk about Consuela's story, which was published in Scalawag magazine. Jordan Green, welcome back to The State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us how Consuela's story came to your attention.
Well, I saw a Facebook post of the photograph, actually, which ran with the story with these two big garish bruises on her face. The post was made by a family member of Consuela's, Byron Gladden, who's actually a member of the Guilford County School Board. And Byron's post was something to the effect of, is it ever justified for a law enforcement officer to do this to a 13-year-old?
Well, let's talk more about this. The day of the arrest, what happened that day? What do we know about that?
Well, sheriff's deputies showed up at the at Southeast Randolph Middle School. The previous day, there had been some kind of altercation between Consuela and another student. What exactly happened is in dispute, but the other student alleges, or the criminal complaint alleges, that Consuela heated up a belt buckle with a lighter or something like that and then pressed it into the flesh of the other student. Consuela says that she was playing around with a belt and it brushed or bumped up into this other student. But in any case, the parent and the principal deemed this a crime that required the deputies to come in and make an arrest. And so Consuela showed up for school the next day and was asked to come to the principal's office. And she saw the deputies standing outside, and things really quickly unraveled and spiraled down from there.
She became angry, used some language at that moment, right?
Yeah, she cursed out the sheriff's deputy, and she started walking away. She pulled out her cell phone to call her brother to tell her brother that there were sheriff's deputies there, and one of the deputies got angry and snatched the cell phone away from her. So what I've pieced together from Consuela's account and talking with her mother and also looking at police reports is that the sheriff's deputies hustled her out of the school and, shoved her into a wall, and then they were trying to escort her out of the building. And she said that they stepped on her toes, and she spat at Sergeant Michael Hogan. And at that point, according to Consuela, is when he struck her in the face. And that's, you can see, I think your listeners will be able to go to your website and see the picture of her with the two contusions. Also in this ordeal, after that, she was thrown onto the parking lot. And she said in one of the officers placed a knee in her back and she was having difficulty breathing.
Stateofthings.org is the place to go to see the picture. That's what she says. What does the sheriff's office say?
The sheriff's office has made no comments to us about it. They asked the SBI to investigate the officer's conduct, so they referred all questions to the SBI. And the SBI has completed an investigation by interviewing Consuela as well as the Sergeant Michael Hogan.
Okay, so at this point, it's important to recap. There was no imminent danger that day. In fact, the police came the day after the initial complaint to make an arrest, and no violence apart from some language. And then we've got this photo of what happens to her. We don't know exactly how, according to the sheriff's deputies, but she's got an account. What should the police? Is there a policy that the school has about the police coming on campus to make an arrest the day after a complaint?
Yes, the school district does have a policy in regards to their school resource officer program. They do have school resource officers on campus. Apparently, these officers were officers that were not assigned to the school. We have a lot of unanswered questions, both from the sheriff's office and the school district. But one of the policies, the school policies to protect students, says that if law enforcement wants to come onto campus to question them, they have the right to have their parents there so that they have protection against self-incrimination. Now, of course, in this case, the incrimination comes from the account of the other student's parents and the principal to the sheriff's office, which forms the basis of the complaint. But the school policy also dictates that arrests should not take place in schools in the presence of other students. Consuela's mom says that she was never contacted by the school about this incident. I wasn't able to get the school's side of that story, but
also put this in context because you talked to the Youth Justice Project at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice to get kind of how this story fits into a larger picture in Randolph County and perhaps elsewhere. Tell us what you found.
This is definitely a concern across the state in both urban and rural school districts. According to the Youth Justice Project, the number of SROs in...
Those are student resource officers, in other words, police.
Yes,
who are assigned to schools, but they go ahead.
School resource officers. Yeah. The number has tripled in the past two decades in North Carolina. And actually also spoke to Consuela's her mother's cousin, Dexter Trogdon, who's a bail bondsman in Randolph County. And he was telling me that he previously worked as a substitute teacher and a coach in the school system and frequently felt like the school administrators over-relied on the police and called in the police to handle discipline issues that that really didn't require law enforcement.
Yeah.
I, I,
Speaks directly to the school-to-prison pipeline, which we're hearing more and more about. We talked about that disturbing statistic. African-Americans make up less than 4% of the population in Randolph County, but more than 25% of the juvenile complaints. NAACP, you talked with the county president of the NAACP, and he had some thoughts on this as well. Tell us what he said.
Yeah, just anecdotally, he said Consuela's story is indicative of police and schools having a heavy-handed approach to students of color. It's hard to get any hard numbers on complaints about excessive force towards students because unless the student and their family decide to come forward, that's a protected encounter with the juvenile justice system is a protected record. But he said that he does have the sense that there are a lot of students of color who are getting roughed up by law enforcement officers in schools.
And in the school, Consuela reported having to endure racial epithets almost routinely, right?
Yeah, there's just a climate of racial tension. She and her siblings and cousins who are people of color, they're from a mixed family. They said that they constantly endure racial epithets, and there was a discussion in her classroom with the teacher that involved building the wall, the Donald Trump's promise, and that was kind of turned against her with the teacher making some comment like maybe we should build a fence around you or something to that effect.
You recently started a project with the journalism organization ProPublica to record incidents of bias. Tell us about that report and what you're doing.
I want to make it clear. I didn't start it. I came in about 6 months into it. It's launched by ProPublica with various news organizations. I Triad City Beats signed on as a partner, and I also helped lead an independent study with Professor Phoebe Zerwick, a great investigative journalist in Winston-Salem at Wake Forest University. So, and we basically, the deal is that bias incidents are way underreported, and law enforcement doesn't necessarily investigate all complaints or pass that on to the FBI, which compiles the national numbers. So what ProPublica is doing is kind of just compiling these incidents, and the students that I'm working with are scraping social media, Facebook and Twitter, to look for evidence of these incidents and then trying to corroborate it. And that information is passed on to journalists that do the legwork.
We will stay tuned. Jordan Green, contributing editor for Scalawag Magazine, also the managing editor of the Triad City Beat. Thank you so much, Jordan.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race. So we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
Now, an emotionally charged day at the courthouse in Hartford today is a former University of Hartford student accused of smearing bodily fluids on her roommate's belongings faced a judge. This is protesters outside the courtroom demanded she be charged with a hate crime. Channel 3 Eyewitness News reporter Patricia Del Rio has more on the dramatic turn of events today. Patricia.
Good evening. Well, protesters and members of the NAACP were very disappointed today that this case was continued until December 18th. They felt strongly that this should be elevated to the level of hate crimes, and they say that this emboldens them and they are just going to continue the fight. Appearing in court with her attorney, 18-year-old Brianna Brochu looked solemn and listened intently as the judge continued the case to a later date. Outside the courthouse, protesters and members of the NAACP carried signs in support of Chanel Jazzy Rowe, a Black University of Hartford student who had her personal belongings contaminated with bodily fluids of her white roommate, Brianna Brochu. Brochu had admitted to the vile acts on Instagram. After the court appearance, Jazzy's supporters felt emboldened to fight to have the charges elevated to hate crime status. Meantime, Brochu's attorney says he's confident it is not going to rise to that level.
It's blatantly obvious that this was premeditated. It was malicious. She thought this out and even admitted to it, posted it. And it's like, we have everything right here. She said it. And we're still having to fight for it. And I feel like this is just another narrative of fighting for Black social justice.
She did some things that she regrets. She's an 18-year-old kid. In my book, that's
no
a child.
Now, the state's attorney's office will not discuss the case, but when Brochu makes her next court appearance December 18th, it is possible that charges can be elevated to hate crime status at that time. Meantime, Brochu's attorney says he does expect that she will enter a plea on that December 18th appearance. I'm Patricia Del Rio, Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
The wisdom of psychopaths. What saints, spies, and serial killers can teach about success.
First, though, Charles Manson, the cult leader and convicted mass murderer, died yesterday at the age of 83.
What do you want to call me a murderer for? I've never killed anyone. I don't need to kill anyone. I think it.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
That was Manson in a 1987 interview with NBC's Today Show. Now, almost two decades earlier, during the summer of 1969, Manson's followers killed actress Sharon Tate and six other people in Los Angeles. After decades in prison, his shadow still looms large. Jeff Gwynn wrote the biography, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, and he's with us now. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, Jeff, the murders were horrific. Describe the mood in Los Angeles after they happened. It was actually months before they discovered the killers, right?
Oh, very much so. And the time between the actual killings and when Manson was apprehended and presented to the public as the leader of the killers, the paranoia really grew. It's almost impossible today to imagine how frightened and how paranoid the atmosphere in Los Angeles was. You've got to remember, you had the Tate killings, five people slaughtered, including an actress whose name was fairly well known. That's in the newspapers one day. The next day, then in Los Feliz, which is an upper middle class neighborhood, two more people are slaughtered. The killings weren't even put together necessarily as done by the same people, but the gruesomeness, people literally butchered, words written on the walls with blood. And throughout Los Angeles, especially in the well-to-do areas, there was just this widespread panic. I mean, who's out there? Anybody could die. I think the best examples are guard dogs were selling for maybe $200 a piece.
Wow.
That was before the murders. On Monday, August the 11th, that's after the 2 days of murder, guard dogs could not be bought in Los Angeles for less than $1,500. Hardware stores sold guns in those days, maybe three or four a day. But now every hardware store in Los Angeles was sold out of guns. I mean, literally 200, 300 guns were being sold at individual stores a day. And the waves of revulsion and fear were touching everybody. Long hairs, hippies, because there was some sense once Manson was first apprehended that, oh, he's just, you know, a hippie. The sort of grisly joke among the hippies was that you may as well not hitchhike anymore. Nobody will pick you up. They're afraid of us all. So it was widespread, and it lasted. It lasted for months. months and months, not just after the killings and Manson's arrest, but all during the so-called Helter Skelter trial.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is, I mean, in this day and age, you've got social media updating things constantly. You've got the 24-hour news cycle updating things constantly. You had to wait till the next day almost to get an update, if there was one, on this story.
Well, there were plenty of updates, and here's the reason why. Manson's timing always worked brilliantly for him and terribly for the rest of the world. Just as this is happening, there is a newspaper war between the two Los Angeles dailies at the time. And they're competing with each other every day because a Manson or Helter Skelter or Tate LaBianca story, I mean, that's just going to pull eyes to your newspaper. So you've got the two newspapers in L.A. every day competing. Who can come up with the grisliest story, the strangest story? And obviously there was plenty of weirdness to go around.
We're talking about the Herald Examiner in the Times, or which?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
And it happened every day, so it keeps escalating. I mean, it's a palpable, almost living thing, this panic, this fear, this paranoia.
Were they trying to one-up each other?
Very much so. Very much so. And every day, there's all kinds of weird claims appearing in the paper. There may have been other murders that are only coming to light. The police have just found a new massive piece of evidence that will allow them to break the case wide open. And yet nothing happened. The killers are still out there. Where are they going to strike next? By this time, Manson's got his followers in Death Valley, mind you. But as far as most of the people in L.A. were concerned, they could be anywhere. If you'd look at the different areas like Santa Monica, weekend nights, teenagers usually would be just roaming the streets,
sure,
packed Sunset Strip. Now that isn't happening. People literally are afraid to walk down the street in Los Angeles.
Speaking to Jeff Gwynn, who wrote the biography Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff, the killings weren't long after the Watts riots. How did racial tension in the city play into the hype around the murders?
Well, that's one of the frightening things when we look back now, because history's cyclical. And some of the things that are happening in America now played a great part in what happened with Manson and the terror of 1969. Los Angeles and the Watts riot became a focus in America of racial unrest, mostly because Los Angeles had always been seen as the safe place, the show business place. And the Watts riots proved that in Los Angeles, violence rumbled right beneath the surface, just like any other major American city. The fear of black militants was not unique to L.A., but it was certainly special there. California, we had the Black Panthers particularly. That was sort of their genesis. And you had an awful lot of white people in Los Angeles who were convinced that there's roving packs of blacks with guns ready to come out any minute now and murder you right after they rape your wife and your daughters.
People really, really believe that.
Absolutely. Just as today we find these white militant groups talking about, oh, you know, we've got to stay a white society. These blacks are savages. We can't have them. The prejudice went all the way back, but Manson knew how to exploit it. He was a demagogue, and that's what demagogues do.
Jeff, if the Manson murders had happened anywhere else, say, I don't know, Seattle, Boise, Idaho, I don't know, would it have gotten the same level of attention? Would we still be talking about Charles Manson as we are today?
Absolutely not. You've got to remember, again, 1969, California, not just for kids in America, for the American public, but all over the world. That's the epicenter of culture. It's, frankly, the epicenter of violence after Watts. But all eyes are focused on California. First San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, where Charlie, pretending to be an all-omniscient guru, had collected most of his kid followers. Los Angeles, the heart of the recording industry, Hollywood. So people were used to looking at Los Angeles anyway for stories that entertained. And gradually, as the Helter Skelter trial went on, people literally began forgetting that simply innocent people had died horribly at the hands of Charles Manson's followers and at his direction. And to a certain extent, it became entertainment. I mean, think of Manson in that day as sort of a criminal Kardashian. He's amusing people. He's yeah. giving them something to look at and think about.
Jeff, how has Manson influenced the way we process high-profile murders in Los Angeles? Because I'm thinking of the Night Stalker, the O.J. trial, the Menendez brothers. They all seem to take a life of their own.
They do for a couple of different reasons. First of all, Los Angeles is an epicenter of media focus today, as it was then, as it has always been. But beyond that, people in the rest of the country, let's say the Midwest or even Texas, where I'm from, there's an exaggerated sense of importance given to cultural events in California, and that very much includes crime and violence. It's not that horrific things don't happen all over the country, but somehow when they happen in California, particularly in Southern California, there's this fine line that's crossed. It's not only something to be repulsed by, but it's entertainment. I mean, look at the ratings these different things yeah. get when there's a TV special. They're the blockbuster movies. Helter Skelter, the book by Vince Bugliosi, who, by the way, could not have been kinder and more helpful when I was writing my book. I'm a great admirer of his. But that book sells 9 million copies. I mean, that just continues to imprint the name Charles Manson in our consciousness. I tried to write a book that would look about why these things could happen and why they'd get so much attention. And you're right. If this had happened, let's say, in Podunk City, Nebraska, no, we wouldn't be talking about them now. But here we are all these years later, yeah. and I think for another generation, Charlie Manson's name is still going to generate. I mean, it's going yeah. to generate interest in Americans.
Jeff Gwynn, author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 25th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have suggestions, thoughts, observations. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. A few things before we get to the callers. Number one, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. You can also support us by visiting the wish list. I know substantial numbers of folks are still Black Fridaying and doing all their purchasing and online gift buying and what have you. I am sure no cows, listeners. But if you are into all of that, feel free to nab a few items from Gus's wish list at Amazon.com. Gus T. Renegade, thanks for all the listeners who have supported Grat Adams, nabbed items for Gus T. Much obliged. I super appreciate the support and hope that the context of white supremacy has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. A few things I wanted to touch on before we get to the listeners. Number one, one of my pals, their sibling, bought a house. Not, you know, news, nothing to write home about per se. People buy houses all the time. She bought a $2.5 million house. She bought a $2.5 million house, paying for it in its entirety in cash. I was a bit stymied. I got the details in staggered information, but after I, went back to confirm what I heard, I could only think, wow, I really wish I had not called her a coon. Joke, I do not name call. That is certainly not in my vocabulary, except when I'm quoting Cal's listeners. I did not name call her, but we did have unpleasant exchange when I shared my views on racism, white supremacy. I've actually known this person. I'm not talking about somebody that I don't know. I've known this person. We have crashed cookouts, hung out, ate together this year, I think multiple times. Known her for years, in fact. But we do not have similar views on white supremacy, racism at all, not even remotely close. And in fact, that is part of the reason we do not have similar views. But be that as it may, once I heard about this extraordinary, the most gangster purchase, really the most gangster thing, period, that I have heard this month and probably for the entire year, I wish we had better relations. That would be grand to have contact with someone like that, or even to go check out the residence. But I said, man, in the future, if you know anyone that you think has the potential that they could have major financial comeuppance, might be good to not discuss racism, white supremacy, if it's going to cause conflict. You can wait and do that at a later date when they will be receptive for that information. But yeah, I did get a good chuckle out of hearing that this week. Other things, the segment on Bianca Brochu, I think that's how you say her name, the white race soldier at the University of Hartford. She's facing misdemeanor charges after her campaign of chemical and biological warfare against her black roommate, or former black roommate at the University of Hartford. With that case, I thought it was important that she is facing a misdemeanor, not a felony, not quote-unquote hate crime charges. She's not thought of as a terrorist. This is all just, chalked up to tomfoolery. Also thought it was important. I think I might have mentioned this before, but it might be worth repeating. There is a movie that came out just this year. It's not worth watching. That's not why I'm not saying the title. But there's a movie that came out just this year where the plot of the film is a white female college student scheming, conspiring to murder her white female roommate. That's the whole plot of the movie. I don't even remember what the reason that she's trying to kill her is. If she didn't wash her laundry in a timely manner or didn't keep her portion of the room clean. I don't even know what the nature of the debate was, but that's the plot of the film. It's kind of a whodunit type thing. And yes, she's trying. In fact, her first attempt, she poisons a chocolate cupcake for her roommate, and the roommate doesn't eat it. She's got dietary restrictions or whatever, and then she has to resort to her second, third, fourth. She has many, many attempts to kill her white roommate. But there is a film that came out about that this year. I think that's important because it reveals so much about white culture, what it means to be white, wisdom of psychopaths, and just violence, constant violence. And I think there is a scheming, a plotting, a viciousness that goes with white identity that I just do not see. I do not see other non-white people with those type of schemes to sabotage a black person, that type of warfare against another person. Whites seem to operate with a different mindset. I could be in error. Continuing, I also wanted to make sure I got in quickly that segment about Seattle, how they, I guess, did not follow through on their quote unquote racial equity work. And this was an initiative that was put forward by former Mayor Ed Murray. Ed Murray is no longer in office because of allegations that he was raping children, and specifically black children. Things didn't change. He was forced to resign after one white person stepped forward and said, one white male, a family member of his, no less, accused him of sexually molesting him when he was a child, and then he had to step down. It went on for months and months and months that he was accused of raping multiple black children, sexually molesting multiple non-white children. And he did not have to step down. Even some of the many candidates who were running for the mayorship of Seattle, many of them did not even say, yeah, I think he should step down. It was, yeah, these are regrettable, but, you know, we'll have to see how things, let things play out. As they say, they gave lots of cliches, buckets of words, but things didn't change until the accusations came from a white person. That's one. And it's the same type of nonsense where you can have a white person who allegedly is against racism to make this sort of initiative. And yeah, we're going to work for progress, racial equity, as they say, in the great Northwest. That doesn't mean he's not a rapist. And in fact, the allegations, he is a raping child racist. And even if that were not the case, it's not followed through on. That's the other aspect of it. And that happens a lot when white people come out and talk about racism, white supremacy. Doesn't mean that they're actually going to do anything. My apologies for the metaphor buckets of words. This is the compensatory call-in. This is the one broadcast where I request if we could not use metaphors, if we could be specific, direct about what it is we want to say. Reason being, I've concluded often whites, racists, they will use comparisons, analogies, similes, metaphors to practice deception. They will contrast or compare two entities that are not similar at all, but they will insist that these two items are equivalent, if not twins. Victims of racism, white supremacy, including Gus T, we've been exposed to this for many years, and we are still learning. Often because of that, we've not come to conclusions on certain ideas, certain concepts. Sometimes when we're talking, we don't have all of the logic to explain what we want to say. Sometimes we will use a metaphor in its place, and it just adds to a lot of confusion. Sometimes we just need to take more time, do a little more thinking, come to a conclusion, and then speak. That is allowed. I have to do that myself sometimes. Again, if we could not use metaphors, I will prompt about that. For this broadcast, if folks could take 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts you have, just to make sure that everyone gets one opportunity to speak. If you have additional comments that you want to get in, great. Just if you could make sure everyone gets one opportunity to speak. And then if you have additional comments, questions that you want to add, we will have ample time. I also wanted to make sure that I got in. There has been many difficulties. This seems to be across sites, across platforms, in terms of the archives, people having difficulty accessing the archives. I have not been able to get, I think, like the last three programs from, I think, Wednesday's broadcast with Mr. William D.C. Clark, which was most interesting. That broadcast and the subsequent two have not been uploaded to iTunes yet. And other people have said that they've had difficulty at SoundCloud and various other sites that are not connected. These are not even, the audio is uploaded at various sites. So these are independent difficulties that people are experiencing, including myself. I wasn't even able to access certain pages that I needed to upload content. The pages simply would not load, and that is extremely odd. At any rate, to be expected, I suspect that that is racist interference, and there's been a lot of that for the duration of the time that we've been on the air. I appreciate the listener who commented on air, I think 2 weeks ago, that The Cows is the only program that he has consistent difficulties accessing on iTunes. At any rate, just making folks aware, the content, you should be able to also access it at YouTube, at Black Talk Radio Network. Trying to think of other sources, SoundCloud as well, even though some people did say that they were having issues even at SoundCloud. But I have been posting the archives on the Twitter page at Until Justice, as well as on the Facebook pages. So you should be able to access the archives for any of the more recent programs until the problem is resolved. Feel free to email any platform, and that would be my suggestion, any platform, if it's iTunes, if it's YouTube, if it's SoundCloud, wherever you're listening. If you have problems accessing the content, send an email. Most of these sites, they have some form of customer service or support. Just send them an email and let them know. And even you can let them know that if it's a pattern that other people are reporting concerns, this is a site that you frequent, you know, you share it with other people. So you're directing traffic to their site. You'd like this problem addressed, corrected, resolved permanently, expeditiously. Drop an email. That might help just whatever platform if you're having problems. With that, number again, 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. One other note, I forgot. A friend, different person, said we should travel to Cuba, really wants to go to Cuba, and they do a lot of traveling, so they racked up a lot of sky miles. Like, hey, I think I even have enough that I could, you know, get tickets so I don't have to go by myself. And, you know, I am always down to travel. I enjoy traveling, and particularly to get out of Seattle, where the sun is not out very frequently right now. It's that time of year. So I absolutely would enjoy being able to go someplace warm for at least a few days, hang out on the beach, brush up on my Spanish. But what I needed was additional motivation. Just going and kicking it on the beach in Cuba for a few days apparently was not enough for Gus T. Asada Shakur is in Cuba. She has done interviews in Cuba, journalists from a variety of different sources, The Final Call, and other journalists have traveled to Cuba and interviewed her. Even some are on film. You can check them out on YouTube. He proposed, hey, why don't you see if you can get information so that you could maybe track down Asada Shakur, see if you could do an interview. I thought, hey, I will solicit. I have checked. I would think that would be a very difficult prospect. And I told him this. I said, she's been added, you know, to the FBI's terrorist list. First female ever added to the FBI terrorist list in the environment that we're in now. I mean, that happened while President Obama was in the White House. What do you think the, you know, climate, as they say, would be now, the environment would be like in terms of additional pressure on her, prosecutions, that sort of thing? I said, I don't know. I checked online. I have not seen any recent interviews. When I say recent, it seems like the most recent interview that I can find is dated like 2002. Like it's been more than 10 years since she's done an interview that I can find. It might just be that I've been inept in my searching. But if folks are aware or would be willing to do some research to see if you can locate, you know, any information about someone, like I said, to me, it just seems very far-fetched, very, very difficult. I don't know that I would, if I were her, just following counter-racist logic, I would not be doing interviews at all. I would be real quiet, nothing to say, knowing racist man, racist woman, racist child. I would not be doing that sort of thing. It just does not seem logical. But if folks have thoughts, info, that would be helpful. With that, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Getting to the phone lines.
Yes, may I be heard?
Our young scholar in the Bay Area, good to hear from you, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, Gustin, to the rest of the callers. I just wanted to discuss the news clip about how Trump calls LeVar Ball an ungrateful fool and whatnot just because of the incident that happened in China. Well, first of all, just I heard about the China incident last week about how three basketball college students, I think from UCLA, went to China, shoplifted, got in a serious amount of trouble for it. My mother showed me the video, and I was not really surprised, but I was surprised that it was taken to this certain level just for shoplifting. But I feel like it's just the shoplifting thing. I just feel like, for one, it shouldn't have been committed in general, because if you, well, my reasoning is, if you can't afford it, then I would not even bother looking at it, rather. But just how LeVar Ball just approached it really got to me, and the way Donald Trump responded to this approach, it really got to me as well. I saw the video on how the three basketball players actually stated their sorrows to Trump. I think they thanked him and the government for rescuing them, quote unquote, from their tragedy. But yeah, just to elaborate on my view, I just feel like Trump just kind of took it too far. But I just feel like he's declaring that he wants to be thanked, but he doesn't want to thank anybody. It just feel like he's just abusing his power a lot, like very much in this particular situation. Most of the situations he's involved in, he just takes his power to straight up to the advantage. It really just got to me, that video about thankfulness and just gratitude. Trump was not grateful for the thanks that he got, but when LeVar Ball got into the situation, he really just went off on him, and it just really got to me. And I still gotta refresh on that just to get valuable information about it. But yeah, that's my views about that. And the first video, I think, which shows about lead paint, I feel like overall it shouldn't be okay to have that in a household of family members. I feel like it should be required to check this amount of lead paint that's present in a household, especially if there's children in there. I feel like there should be no reason as to why that there's lead paint still present, even if it was inspected. I just feel like the main reason that it's still present, especially in a black household, is because one person supports black genocide. That's what I would say. Because I feel like it's mostly present in black families, black households, especially for those who are poor and can't really afford it. And I feel like it's just the main target for lead paint is to target those who are poor, but also black, especially in household family members. But that's my views about it. It shouldn't be present in that type of situation, I feel. But I don't know. But I'm not sure. It's just, who knows? I'm just a black child trying to survive. But yeah, that's how I feel about it. And that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
One second. Caller in the Bay Area, Thomas in New York, has been waiting for a long time to get a question in. Now that both of you are here, Thomas in New York, did you want to ask your question?
Good evening, Gus. How are you? I know right poorly. Good evening, young scholar from the Bay. Yeah, I had a question for you. It was a very simple question, I just want to see the answer you gave. I want to know, how many oceans are there in the world?
In the world, just as my education process is and what I've been taught, I think there are 4 oceans on the planet.
Interesting. Okay. And I only asked that because my kids came home with some work, and apparently white supremacists added 5 now. It's 5. So I thought that just wanted to see if that was the consensus around the country, because it blew my mind when I saw there was a 5th ocean now. That was the question I have for you, sir.
Oh, so what was the 5th one declared as, and where is it?
They call it the South Ocean. And apparently, like, under Brazil, down in South Antarctica region, it's the South Ocean now, which I thought was very interesting, that they added a new ocean.
Oh, I guess they're just adding a lot of stuff now. That particular ocean, I think, if it's by Antarctica, it kind of makes sense, but it's too late to kind of declare it now because I feel like that's just where the top three oceans submerge or meet. I think those oceans are the Pacific, Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean because it's just right there and it just comes all by the Antarctica. But that could also be the Arctic Ocean because the North and South Pole, they kind of revolve. But I'm actually not sure. I have to actually look into that because I have not heard this ever.
Wow. Wow. Okay, well, see how they teach our kids differently coast to coast. You know, he's in the Bay Area. I did have written down in my commentary something about LeVar Ball that I think you'll find interesting. But our president, Donald Trump, to me, in my opinion, I said before that LeVar Ball should be awarded for training his kids to break this code of, you know, you got to make the NBA and you got to go and get a deal with Nike and make a bunch of people rich and you don't really get to eat as much. You know, you don't get as much. And for him starting his kids with their own sneaker company, I thought was great. In China, there was 46 capital. There are 46 capital offenses. None of them is shoplifting. You know, the white media is lying when they talk about there's a so-called 3 to 10 years for shoplifting. That's all propaganda to make China look bad. China has 1.5 billion people, but yet it has a fraction of the jail population of New Jersey. So they're not just trying to throw people in jail for anywhere. Penalty for shoplifting in China is less stiff than the penalty for shoplifting in the United States. China has a shaming culture. If you steal, their thing is more or less they'll shame you. You know, bring you to your family, you know, that would be enough to, you know. But according to their law, minor offenses and administrative penalties, the police punish minor offenses that are not regarded having breached the criminal law. Those punishments are referred to as administrative because the police make their decisions. There is no public hearing. No defense is available. A variety of legislation and administrative regulations that authorize different types of administrative penalties. Police have great discretion in imposing such sanctions. A court can subsequently review an administrative penalty, but they cannot interfere. There are two main types of administrative penalties. One is the public order punishment authorized by the regulations on penalties for public safety, public security, 1957. The regulations are administrative in nature, punishing petty theft and other activities disrupting public order. Punishment is administered by police and may include warning, a fine, or administrative detention for no less than 15 days. There are over 3 million public orders of offense handed out in China for every year, and no one has ever gone to jail yet. So what Trump is saying is a lie. He wasn't going to jail for 3 to 10 years. It just doesn't happen in China. Never. They're not white people. I just wanted to also say, Gus, if I could continue, I've been watching the Zimbabwe situation. And all I can say to that is, welcome to New Rhodesia. Dancing in the street, bucking hard. For a new enhanced version of apartheid. I just think that, you know, they haven't learned from history. It's just sad to see. Of course, Europe has total control of Africa and their resources, and I don't see them giving that up. And I did have something else to say, but I know I'm probably hitting the 5-minute mark, so I'll mute my line. Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it, and certainly I am right poorly. We did have a number of metaphors there, though, with the ball situation so that he can eat metaphor and then comparing what's happening in Zimbabwe that's saying it's a new Rhodesia. And that's what I mean about sometimes when we use metaphors.
Oh, God.
Nope, no apologies needed. Just it's good to get the specifics, right? Because if you're talking to someone and they don't know anything about Rhodesia, they don't really know what you're talking about. That's what I mean can happen often with the metaphors. Other folks have commentary they would like to share. Oh, and I'm reading from thoughtco.com. The International Hydraulic Organization created the fifth and newest world ocean, the Southern Ocean, in 2000. So, recent change reminded me of Pluto. I think the late Dick Gregory did a skit where he was talking about Pluto is no longer a planet. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. That is what domination, supremacy, that's what it looks like. Today we said it's 9 planets. Tomorrow it's going to be 8, and that'll be that. Monday we said it's 4 oceans. Tuesday we say it's 5. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed. Apparently, we have lots of spectators. If you are still doing your Thanksgiving grub, okra, chitlins, or whatever it is, if you can take a moment, and if you have any thoughts or commentary you would like to share, hopefully we do not have spectators. That does not help replace white supremacy with justice. And this program certainly is not intended for spectators. I hope folks did not get a slab of pie or cobbler or whatever it is and think that we're just going to prop our feet up and, you know, listen to what folks are talking about. This is designed for participation. So if you have commentary, again, 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943#. Press *6 if you would like to participate.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I actually did have a piece of sweet potato pie, but I'm not about to sit here with my feet up and not participate. Hello, everybody. This is 712 calling, and I wasn't able to listen to all of the clips. The one that stood out to me that I did get to listen to, the police officer, state trooper, having some type of issue with his grandchild and wanting that grandchild to the point where the parents actually had to go on the run and like try to leave and escape this guy. This man is a race soldier. He's a trooper. And I was happy to find out that when the parents and the child, if I have the clip right, came to Iowa, how the trooper was able to, you know, the race soldier was able to get on the phone, call his other fellow race soldier peoples and say, hey, I'm in Georgia. Y'all are in Iowa. I got some people on the run and I need y'all to help me get those people. And so that, you know, that just gave more proof to how it's this big giant network of racists that stick together. And, you know, they just make phone calls to make stuff happen. Race soldiers sticking together. And that's all I wanted to comment on right now. And also, Gus, thanks for picking that book out. I wasn't able to listen to all of the second, but I will. And that is a great book. It really speaks to the mindset of what we talk about every week on the Cow, the mindset of racist white supremacists. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. And gratitude again to Dr. Rasayan. I spoke with him earlier this week. I woke him up. It's 3-hour time difference between us. I think it was like 12:30 his time. But he didn't even mind. And I gave him some thanks over the phone. And he had great things to say about the book. And I have not read the book yet. So he was telling me some of the things to anticipate and the timing. I think I called him like the day after Charles Manson died. And he's prominently featured. I'm Wisdom of Psychopaths this coming Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Still threatening my top 10. Wow. Not because it's a fantastically written book, but because of what our caller just said, it reveals a lot about what it means to be classified as white. Incidentally, that story about the spat between the white trooper grandpa and the white son. Wow. The thing that I thought was significant or that stood out to me is another pattern. I'm pretty sure that that is not the first act of racism that the white son has seen from his father. I have seen where white people, if they have some sort of spat with each other, that white person might rat out that other white person as being a racist. I've seen this where a wife got divorced, white woman, she got divorced from her husband, who was also happened to be an enforcement officer, and she leaked text messages where he was calling black people's niggers and called the NAACP coons and all this other stuff. She leaked it after they got a divorce, right? That's part of her, you know, take that for the road. Excuse the metaphor. That's part of her retaliation, seeming like she's doing something vindictive since she's having a part with her former ex-husband or ex-husband. But I've seen that. That must be something that's, well, I won't say, that must be a violation of white code. I would think logically it has to be. You're not supposed to be calling out other white people as racist. A white person is never supposed to be indicting another white person as racist, much less going and digging out evidence, specific acts to say, yes, see, he did this and did this. Racist, that's not supposed to happen. So I would have to think that's got to be a violation of white code, but I have noted a pattern of that sort of thing happening. But I'm real sure if someone were to ask the son, is this the first time that you've heard your pa use the word nigger, and see what he says. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I attempted to, I think, send you a message about with the Charles Manson, well, the whole thing behind Charles Manson as far as the murders are concerned. I read somewhere, I just can't remember exactly where I read it at. It may have been in his autobiography, and when I mean his autobiography, I'm talking about the courageous Elmer Geronimo Pratt, that the first person that was accused of some of those murders was him, that the LAPD first accused him of those murders, because at the time they were trying to pin something on Mr. Pratt as the, I think he was the chief of security of the LA chapter in Los Angeles at the time, and he was very proficient, evidently, of what he was saying and doing, to whereas the system of racist white supremacy was attempting to put him in greater confinement and or execute him. I read it somewhere. I just can't confirm it because I forgot on where I actually read that at. Moving on. That's my thoughts on Charles Manson, one of them anyway, as far as my memory is concerned. Just thinking about how confused we as non-white people are collectively on the system of racist white supremacy, and it's right in our face, showing, revealing itself to us daily. But in our confusion, some of us really, responding to that attention that it's getting when you have the person that's in the office of president that is called the United States is daily. And I not only that, I hope he stays in office for another 4 years after the fact. If they can get some more years, it'll be In a way, it'd be good for non-white people as far as bringing us to reality, as far as thinking as a strategy is concerned. It's some other thoughts that I had, but I don't want to exceed through the 5 minutes, so I'll let it go at that for right now. Thank you.
I will have to check again to see. I've been trying to check online to see if Geronimo Pratt, to confirm if he was accused of any of the Manson crimes. I remember, I know he was convicted, the case they were called the tennis court murders, but I'm not sure if Manson was, did Manson confess to those crimes, or was he convicted for those crimes?
You mean
the tennis court?
You said Manson?
Correct.
To the crimes that he eventually was convicted on?
Just the tennis court murders. I know that was the case. It was a white woman.
Oh yeah, well, with Mr. Pratt, that's what he was convicted on.
Right.
And basically, as you know, it was pinned on him, and he didn't get the support that he thought he probably should have gotten from the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, and that actually was the means of him going to prison for that long period of time for something that he had nothing to do with at all.
Right.
So basically, he was a part of, you know, what a lot of people understand as a political prisoner.
Right.
There still is some who's behind bars right now, but like I said, I can't confirm it. So, but I think I recall reading somewhere where the first person that was accused, I didn't say convicted, but accused, accused of the Tate LaBianca murders was Geronimo Pratt. In other words, they were searching around for something to pin on him, and they eventually pinned on that tennis court murders things on him. I just can't. I have to find the information that I read to be able to be affirmative on that.
Oh, okay.
So I don't want to say for sure. I just thought it was an interesting thought about you posting Charles Manson, and that's the first thing that comes to my mind when I hear about Charles Manson. Other than, yes, he is, the book on psychopaths, which I haven't joined in the reading yet, I would match him up with the word psychopath, you know, in itself. As a whole lot of other white people. So
right on. I was able to check online, and my BFF, Amy Goodman, she did an interview with Geronimo Pratt from 2000. This is after he was released from greater confinement. And I'm reading from the transcript where he does talk about being a victim of COINTELPRO and falsely charged and all that. He says also, there was so much going on at the time. I was charged with so many murders. As I had indicated earlier, I was charged with the Tate LaBianca murders. I was picked up for it before Charles Manson. I was also picked up for another murder on the West Side in which this youngster went and took part and killed someone, and they would hold us without bail. So I was thinking at this time that this was another murder or another tactic they were using to keep me from making bail. And then he goes on to talk about the linked Johnny Cochran. But you can go, I'll post the link so people can hear this interview. This is from 2000. Geronimo Pratt, he passed, I believe, in 2011. I might be incorrect about the date, but I know he's been gone. He's transitioned. I know it's been close to 10 years. Other folks, if you have commentary, the number 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Good mention, retired firefighter. Let's see. I take it folks are still spectating, hanging out. Hope people are not looking at this as a holiday, counter-racism. It's not about taking holidays. Should be using our brain computer. And just, I felt like it was a good bit to process with regards to things that happened over the past 7 days. Quite a few things to talk about, even internationally. I think Thomas in New York was talking about what happened in Zimbabwe as well. Mhandisi, if you had commentary, you should be with us as well, sir.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mhandisi. The same thing as I've said before, just being that, well, I guess I'll modify it some, is that if a black person is going to be a speaker for black people, you know, deciding to quote unquote lead black people in any direction, they should have some type of strategy. They should have some strategy to defeat white people. If a black person does not have a strategy to defeat white people, then I don't see a reason to really be speaking in public or out front or trying to convince black people to do anything. If you don't have a strategy to win, then it would just be a waste of time, in my opinion, to do a whole lot of trying to direct people. But yeah, every black person should have a strategy to win. Every black speaker should definitely have a strategy to win. And we just have to defeat white people. That's just the bottom line. We have to do it quickly. I think that we have to do it before they finish implementing a lot of the technologies that are out. We have to do it before they implement other plans that are, you know, obvious. You can certain troop movements, certain calls to action from your enemy, you can not just predict, but some of them are just kind of told to you, you know, like we don't even have to predict. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that we can prepare for. And I just say, let's defeat them. Let's do it quickly. It's possible. And we have to know it's possible. Thank you.
There absolutely should be a sense of urgency with regards to solving this problem immediately. I think Dr. Cambon, when he was on one of his earlier visits, he said, talking about individuals classified as white, their capacity for evil is not in their past, but in their future. And I think that is just, again, there should be a tremendous urgency about solving this problem as soon as possible, immediately. And that should be reflected in how we use our time and energy. That's something I try to emphasize on the broadcast consistently with regards to not wasting time. Even, like I said, the past few days, you get some time off from work. That time shouldn't be wasted. That's one thing that none of us has an infinite amount of time. Really be, really value your time and energy. Mr. Steele, do you have commentary? You should be with us, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Is it echoey in here, or should I change venues, or am I coming in clear?
No echo thus far. I think you're good. You're good, Mr. Steele.
Awesome. Perfect. Okay. Greetings, everyone. I just wanted to start this broadcast by saying that you know, Robert Mugabe is a hero to counter racists worldwide. If you read into his story, I think he at one point in time was an agent of the United Kingdom. And has even been knighted. He even has an honorary PhD from my alma mater, Michigan State University. And he was celebrated by racists worldwide until they came to understand that in him that they would not have some sort of puppet regime where they would be able to further abuse the former colonized, or even, I guess, still colonized people of Zimbabwe. And, you know, it should be understood that his revolution, or the revolution to create the Zimbabwe, you know, the spirit of that revolution is not dead with the I guess, ascension of his successor. I don't have the correct pronunciation of his last name, but I believe his first name is Emmanuel. And his name's the Crocodile. This guy is a hardliner from the revolutionary days. He fought alongside Mugabe. So when I hear all of these commentators like, and, you know, I don't use these terms, and I don't think that it's appropriate to use these terms, but I'm just going to use them because I've heard victims say them. Kumbabwe, you know, and talk of Rhodesia 2.0, and, you know, most of the evidence that they're using to make these claims are pictures of Africans embracing affected racists in the street in reaction to the resignation of Mugabe. And then they use the quote from the new president of Zimbabwe saying that he pledges to compensate displaced or, I guess, former colonizers who had holdings within the area that they call Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. He made the claim that they were going to compensate them for their losses. And I think it's a little short-sighted by some of these commentators to write off this announcement as some sort of heralding of a new era of white supremacy in Zimbabwe for a few reasons. One, the white supremacists, while their numbers have been dwindled in the area formerly known as Rhodesia, they still hold a significant portion of the fertile land. I believe I read some sources saying that suspected racists hold up to 70% of the fertile land that's in the country called Zimbabwe. So they're already there. They've been there since the revolution. And talk of, you know, genocide and, you know, attacks on white farmers, I think, are overblown and overstated by the racists. So, you know, I don't think that there will be much significant change in that part of the status quo. And then also, it should be noted that we will compensate you for your losses is a very diplomatic phrasing of a promise that a lot of victims of racism make but rarely fulfill. The I'm a pay you line. I honestly think that this vice president is playing politics when he makes those claims of compensation. All of the news outlets by suspected racists do not like this guy. They are decrying his pledge to compensate these white farmers, and they're saying that they do not anticipate there will be any truth to those words, and I'm glad for that. And I suspect the same is true as well. I think that the government of Zimbabwe is using this transition as an opportunity to look for a reset on their relations with the global international economic system. And making these claims of compensation is one way of doing that. And it should be also noted that the land reform programs that did mark one of the biggest and most contentious parts of Mugabe's revolutionary government is not going to change. The president, the new president, made this very clear that the land will continue to be repatriated to Native Africans. So you know, I think that this is it's very disturbing to hear just the pessimism and the ignorance and the anti-blackness in the analysis of the events that took place in Zimbabwe. And finally, you know, just bear in mind that the Zimbabwe military made that move after 93-year-old Robert Mugabe fired his
most trusted military compatriot from the revolution in favor of creating a pseudo monarchy that would be headed up by his former secretary, or I think a receptionist, Grace Mugabe, who is referred to by some as Gucci Grace, as I guess a nickname that she earned for her expensive taste in clothes. But you know, again, this is these are politics that we here in the United States are not very familiar with. We don't know the inner workings of the Zimbabwe government. Much of the information that we get of Zimbabwe comes directly from the white supremacists themselves. And to call it Coombabwe is not only an insult to Robert Mugabe, it's an insult to all of the people of Zimbabwe and to black people worldwide. So please refrain from making such rash judgments and using such anti-black language to refer to the transition of power that went on in Zimbabwe. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate it. That is certainly something that would, I think, be greatly helpful in getting this problem solved expeditiously, addressing anti-blackness and trying to minimize that as much as possible. When we were talking about that last week on the Global Sunday Talk, I think the consensus was kind of we'll have to see how it goes to see, you know, kind of what happens. It wasn't celebrating and you know, things are going to be wonderful. It wasn't, you know, Coombabwe or anything like that. It was, let's see, you know, how this evolves. We'll have to pay attention over a while. That's, yeah, definitely. I'm always think it's constructive to try to get as much information as possible about how things are evolving. But that anti-blackness, racists have done a phenomenal job at contaminating us so that that ends up being a consistent way that we respond, how we think about, talk to other black people, think about black people worldwide. If we can work to eradicate that, that would be grand. And even paying attention to media coverage, that was something we talked about last week as well, because if white people in respected, what they call mainstream outlets, if they are talking in a condescending way about what's happening in Zimbabwe, I suspect that that strongly influences that anti-blackness and how a lot of black people, how a lot of non-white people all over the world will think about and talk about that situation. And I believe Spirit of the Revolution, I believe that is a metaphor. If other folks have commentary they would like to share, line should be open. Greetings, Emmy. Good to hear from you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. There was a lot to think about in this broadcast selections of news that we had. I was kind of struck by a pattern that I observed in a couple of the clips. I wasn't really sure what, and it's, I don't know if this is the showcasing, but it's using, what I'm talking about is using black people as justification or as a scapegoat, or I'm not trying to use a metaphor, but just like black people are being brought up in a like for no reason. So with the father and the grandfather in Georgia, what did that really have to do with him talking about killing people so he could see his granddaughter? The fact that he use so-called racial slurs. What does that do? Does that, I mean, that to me, it didn't have anything to do with anything. And although I do agree with Gus that I'm sure white people are not supposed to do that to each other, break white code, I just have observed a pattern where we get used far too often and it's never to our benefit. I wasn't sure if maybe I just didn't hear properly or I missed it, but were the young black males actually like, I mean, well, they didn't have a trial, so I guess we don't know if they actually stole anything, But I feel that, I mean, there's a high probability that they didn't. And having removed them from China really quickly and did whatever was done, you know, to smooth it over or make it less of a crime, or I don't know, whatever happened. But I feel like that kind of makes them seem guilty, as though they did do it. And I could be in error. Maybe they did, and I don't know. But I feel like that would have gotten more attention if they actually had. So I'm not so sure. I'm not someone who cares a lot about nationalities and titles and all that stuff, and like being American and whatnot. But I'm really, really, and I don't pay as much of attention to the news as I should, but I am really, really amazed that the whole everything with Trump, I think, is just, I don't even know. Like, it's almost, it's like a, not only say light, because that would make it a metaphor, but it is a tragic comedy. I don't even know how this is possible. I never in my wildest dreams ever imagined a political situation this tacky, and I'm alive for it. So I'm not so sure. I think there's legitimate evidence. There's evidence, enough evidence to suggest that perhaps Trump is doing these things to keep people from paying attention to other things. But even if that is the case, why does it oftentimes, that I at least hear about it, have something to do with race? Aren't there so many other things that he could say and do to remove people's focus from whatever sleight of hand or whatever other thing he's trying to do? So I'm not really sure about that. I think that just is who he is. I think there's enough evidence to suggest that that's so. I am aware of it, but I don't often think about it as too much. And this will be the last thing I talk about, just because it just amazes me. I didn't go to school. We didn't have a law enforcement officer in my school. I don't think so. We maybe had a security officer, but I don't even think that either. So I have to be reminded and think about it, that there are schools that have law enforcement officers in them, and that they have all of this leeway to do whatever they want to do. I looked online, but it was like really quickly because I was doing something else, to try to find the image and to see the young girl. But I think she is Black, like from whatever I could see for a second, like she looks non-white, she looks Black. But I could be in error. And I just wanted to just say something about that, because I'm always shocked to realize that, you know, so many really bad things are happening to really young people in schools with police officers. Like, just in my short time participating in the COWS, those clips are very, very frequent. And that's all. So I thank you all for listening.
There is a picture of the Black girl who was beaten. I posted it on the Facebook page. She's not crystal Black. I'll put it that way. You can judge for yourself from the Facebook page. She does not look like she would be classified as white, but it has her name and information. You can check it out on the COWS Facebook page. It's on the COWS Facebook page. I did not go to a school where we had a security officer either. I think we had like one, I don't even know what you, support staff person who just kind of roamed the hallways to patrol and check on things. And he was in his 80s. So yeah, we didn't have that, but those type of incidents happen all the time. And I mean, as she stated, it's easy. Some weeks there are 4, 5, 6 different types of incidents like that, just dealing with the school situation. Again, same thing I said already, play around with sex. Joke, yes, the joke is on the offspring. Really want to think way in advance about the academic plan for your child, way in advance, because this is what will be waiting on your daughter, your son. Other folks, if you are with us, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Black female caller in New York, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes. Thank you. Good evening, Gus, to the callers and the listeners. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Here in South Carolina, every school has a law enforcement officer in them, as evidenced by about a year ago, the race soldier throwing the child who was seated in her chair, the black female, to the floor and assaulting her. Every school in South Carolina, I'm a substitute teacher, has a officer in station assigned to the schools, every last one of them. Two things I wanted to comment on. I didn't hear the clips. I just got in from not too long ago from a wedding, two black people attempting to be married in the system of white supremacy. A wonderful wedding. Very fortunate to know them. And it was happening at the start of a rivalry game between the Clemson Tigers and the University of South Carolina Gamecocks. So there are white people running around downtown, inebriated, lawless. There were two ambulances and three police cars were in the area passing me as I was en route back home. And the game had only started at 7 o'clock, and I was leaving at 7:38. So they are out and about frolicking, beer, cases of beer in hand, no bags, exercising their quote-unquote privileges in the system. Two things I wanted to mention. I don't know if anybody really paid attention to the fact that Donald Trump actually said that he was going to play a round of golf with Tiger Woods. I thought that was real interesting, considering the way we, white people dragged, I don't want to, is that a metaphor? Yes. White people degraded Mr. Woods for his unfortunate arrest this summer. But the president can mention that he had he's playing golf with him, and nobody says a word. But they're focusing more on the times that he played golf rather than compared him to Mr. Obama's playing golf. But I didn't hear anybody say anything about him playing golf with Tiger Woods. I mean, I might have missed it. But anyway, the second thing I wanted to comment on is with all of these people who are have these jobs in government getting getting lambasted and found out about their sexual exploits. I think we should wait for a sexual exploit with a person of the same gender to appear. I think that's going to be next. That might happen next week or something, maybe the week after. I'm talking about what do we call these same-sex type things. We can look for that to happen as well. And in my opinion, and I could be wrong, with all of the attention being given on, you know, this Weinstein guy and Franken and Conyers and the judge, I forget his name, Moore or something like that, with all of the attention being put on that and knowing the way the supremacists are guiding us with regard to this whole genderless way of living, and I could be wrong, but it seems to me that what they're doing is priming us and prepping us and grooming us for to not want to be who we are. For example, you have women who are, you know, naturally attracted to men, but they saying, oh my goodness, look what happens. I mean, young women, look what happens if I'm a woman. You know, look how men are going to treat me. So don't want to be a woman. And then there are men who, you know, well, you know, if I come on to a woman, or if I say I like a woman, or if I date a woman, look what can happen to me. So I think that this whole thing is a part of that whole normalization, that skewed normalization process that has been happening for quite some time now. I think that, you know, a lot of it happened when Obama was in office, but since Trump is in office, I believe that that's what this whole thing is about. I don't think it's about us finding out and pointing fingers and saying, I really would think this is this whole gender war thing that Mr. Fuller talks about, men wearing dresses, men not wanting to be men for what can happen to them, or women not wanting to be women for what can happen to them. And this is already, it's very, very effective in the school systems already. So I just wanted to mention that. Like I said, I could be totally wrong about that, but I think that this whole thing is part of this genderless agenda. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line. Thank you for listening.
Appreciate that. Black female caller in New York. I have to think about that theory. That is one I'll ponder on. There have been a number of same gender accusations of sexual abuse already. I think it could be that all of the accusers of Kevin Spacey, who said that he did something sexually incorrect, are males. If it's not all, I know a substantial number are males. And I think quite a few. I think Mr. Cruz, Terry Cruz, the black male, I think he said that it was a white male Hollywood producer who groped his genital area. I think there have already been a number of allegations of males molesting other males. Is that what you were talking about in terms with regards to same gender accusations?
Yes, but I was talking about more so with the congressmen and the senators. I'm talking about in D.C. I'm well aware of the Hollywood and the music industry, you know, but also with children as well. I think that we can just wait for it. It's happening, and that was another part of the whole normalization thing. Is, you know, to have sex with children, to have these relationships with children. So, I mean, I just that's what I believe this is all about. This is not about pointing fingers or shaming anybody. It's a part of this normalization process. Thanks, Gus.
Appreciate that. I will say I heard it was Mumia. I had a lot of audio. I say every week that I have more audio clips than I can play, but Mumia Abu-Jamal, he did an audio segment where he was talking about all of these allegations facing high-ranking elected officials and entertainers and the whole game. And he was saying that he thought this moment represented women galvanizing to, you know, take back their power, and they're not going to just be subjected to this tyranny anymore, sexual tyranny anymore. He said that he thinks the Women's March Against Trump galvanized this movement. And I paused and I said, how could that be if most white women voters voted for Trump? How could that be that this is the jump off for their quote unquote women's liberation movement when a sizable chunk of them had to vote for President Trump? That just, at minimum, it seems very contradictory to me. But yeah, I will have to give thought to that. Other folks can share a line on that as well. Did any of the folks listening in, do folks think it would be possible, like in the realm of this is something that is very doable with regards to going to Cuba to try to get an interview with Assata Shakur? Do you think she would even be available to do interviews given everything that she's facing at this point, now being added to the FBI's terrorist list and the new administration in the White House, the state of global politics? Do folks think that's something that could reasonably happen?
So can I answer?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think that I know I'm far away. Hold on. Got the wrong headphones. I think that it is possible if Assata Shakur is as up to date with things as Mumia is behind bars. You know, for all we know, she might listen to the show. It's counter racist. I'm quite sure this would be up. I don't want to say up her alley, but this would be in line with her theory. However, if she hasn't, I would think that it would be pretty risky like you mentioned earlier, for her to do that. And if she does it, I wouldn't be mad at her at all, because, you know, with the current administration, anything can happen.
I was not thinking that she could be listening to the program, although I guess that is a possibility. They do have Wi-Fi in Cuba, but definitely the logic of it. That's what I was thinking. Like, you know, I just wouldn't – I would not be very available, or there would have to be an extraordinary vetting process for all of that, because I just, you know, I just don't know what the benefit would be to be a media sensation and trying to talk to anybody who can catch a
– If you do reach out to her, Gus, maybe if you send her a few episodes – and she could kind of get, you know, maybe spread out for the years, so she could see the years of work that you put in and see how dedicated you are. That would help, especially the Sue Africa episode. I think that would be a great I think she'll get a chuckle out of that one.
Woo! Hope that she is not pen pals with Sue Africa, but yeah, that would be a hoot. Would love to do it. It would be great to get it, because like I said, I just haven't seen any. That is also gave me pause. I have not seen newer interviews. Like I said, I think the most recent one that I saw was like 2002. So I don't know. She might be a bit more of a recluse at this point, which would make sense as well. But if there's folks can find, if there are newer interviews or anything that would help with regards to information on that, that would be great, because I wouldn't even know a starting point. Cuba is not that big. I've flown over Cuba going to Jamaica, but that would seem a bit daunting to plop down and just be like, who knows Assata Shakur? How would we make that happen? So, yeah. Folks have any other thoughts on that or additional comments, feel free.
May I be heard?
Ma'am.
The last time that we heard publicly from Ms. Shakur, if I'm not mistaken, was that the time when she was put on the FBI terrorist list and she responded?
I don't even recall a response. I know Democracy Now! Did a segment on that, and they played an audio clip, but it was an archived audio clip. Like, it wasn't
okay.
A response to what was happening. And then they had like Angela Davis and some other people on the talk, but I don't remember. If that does exist, that would be great to hear, but I can't off recollection remember that there was even a live response to that.
So was that archived? Because I may have been, I thought it was a response to that archived clip. Was that the one where she talked about exactly how she got into that predicament, and exactly how, why she went to Cuba, and what had happened? Was that the audio clip that Democracy Now! Played? Was that the archive clip? Because I do remember hearing that.
I will have to double check. I'm looking at it now. She was placed on the FBI terrorist list in the spring of 2013. So again, my BFF, Amy Goodman, they were on their job and they talked about this, and listed Assata Shakur in her own words, rare recording of activists named to FBI most wanted terrorist list. And then I'm looking at the transcript to see what she's talking about. I think, yes, this is it, where she's talking about how she ended up being there, the COINTELPRO attacks against her. Yes, this is it. And so this is archived. This is from...
Okay. Okay.
I was going to see if they put the year on when... Okay, so this is from 1998.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's,
okay.
That's us. I don't see a lot of new stuff. The new stuff that I've seen, there's like written articles, written essays, interviews from like 2002 and that time period, but I'm not really seeing anything more recent than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised if she was very, very, I mean, she would, if she ever heard this recording of Sue Africa, the show, I'm quite sure she would not be surprised. That's just my thinking, that she will not be surprised at all.
Let us hope so.
I would. Could I be heard?
Yes, we heard. I can hear you, retired firefighter. Was that Emmy as well? Were you speaking up also?
It was, but I'll wait.
I was just going to say that I think getting an interview with her would be difficult at best. I would suspect the only way to get the interview is that you would have to qualify through some white people, because I suspect the reason why she has not been captured is because of maybe some white people that helped her get to Cuba in the first place. I would have to say that in the events of her getting to Cuba, some white persons or person assisted her, and you would have to go through that filter in order to get an interview. And I said difficult at best is because that's probably the reason why she has not been interviewed for a very long time, is because of the risk of her capture. And once again, I repeat myself that I think the only reason why she has not been captured at the same time is because of the white person or persons that assisted her escape from this part of the world to the island of Cuba. Hopefully I made some sense.
That does make sense. I think whites did, or at least one white person did, assist her in getting to Cuba. And I know there's a video where she did a whole like conference lecture type thing with a multitude of people. There's video of this on YouTube. This is, I think it's in like the 90s, but that's on YouTube. So it seems at least for a period of time, there was, I guess, some vetting process, or she did do interviews, but I don't know. She might have cut back on that sort of thing. Emmy, you were going to comment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Although I think it would be fantastic to have an interview with Assata Shakur, I, for some reason, just feel like I'd like to put it on the record that perhaps going to Cuba and attempting to do that might not be the most constructive thing, just because so let's say you get it and then you share it, you have now the latest recording of Assata Shakur on the Cows podcast. So I believe that the Cows is being monitored. I don't know. Maybe I'm just stressed and scared and paranoid, but I just don't see it being really that good. Now, if you got it, and I guess you just kept it and we didn't get to hear it, then I guess that could be just for you and her, you know, something that transpired but wasn't really shared. But if it was, I could see it being not good, because then that means you have contact with her or have had contact with her. And then who knows? Now, maybe iTunes won't even load the Cows anymore, ever. But, I mean, it would be great. I mean, I don't know any of, you know, like when the last time she spoke or anything like that. But that was just something I was thinking about. So thank you.
That is legit as well. That's definitely something to consider with COINTELPRO and black identity extremists operating currently. That is definitely something to consider I have the most current interview with the first female placed on the FBI terrorist most wanted list. Yes, that certainly would be something to consider. Some powerful whites might want to have a conversation about lots of things after such activity. Other folks have commentary? Right on. Folks are still spectating and or having fun from the holidays, I presume.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. This is Iman DC. I was just going to say a book that my uncle had suggested to me and that I would just pass on the information is a book called The Earth is Flat It's on audiobook. I listened to it, and it's basically, it's a long book, a very long book, that just says that now, given the current technologies that are out, the rest of the world, the rest of the non-white world, is able to compete with the white world on a level that they weren't able to compete with before. And now perhaps there's a level playing field, as the book says it. There's perhaps now it would be easier for non-white people to beat white people given the technology, but you kind of have to read into what they're saying. The other book I would suggest is Land Grabbers, The New Fight Over Who Owns the Earth. And it just talks about white people taking big pieces of land. Of course, white people, quote unquote, own all the land around the world. But this particular book is just talking about more privatized ownership and the big purchases that they've taken, and then the repercussions that the non-white people have, given that they're being pushed off of their land and their lands are being fenced off, so you know they no longer have access to that piece of land. And then the amounts of water, the extreme amounts of water that they certain crops. It's all in that book. It's an interesting book. Perhaps somebody could find that constructive. And then the other thing is with this broadcast, and then just black people, period, that are putting up your content, your counter-racist content on these search engines, including YouTube and whatever other search engine, I would just say people should be of what they head or what they title the video under or whatever the content, whatever you titled the content under, that's important because that's how the search engine pulls up that particular content or that particular information. And I would just say, I think the Cal should do a few. I don't know if you did any broadcasts with the title of white genocide, at least I couldn't find it. But that would be a good topic, a good title to put up content under. And then the other, I always look up information under white genocide, under white extinction, under anti-white, under white survival, under a number of other things. But if you title your broadcast, your shows under these particular, I think there's some benefit to it because of the particular people who would be searching this particular information. And then the other thing to pay attention to is the order of the search. There's different ways that, let's say YouTube, for instance, you can search for files based on when they were updated, the last updated, and then so it will pull yours up, your broadcast up on the search to number one just because it's you did the earliest broadcast or the latest broadcast on genocide. I do think that's something that could be looked at. Thank you.
Appreciate that suggestion. I will see if we can get that done post haste. That shouldn't be too difficult. So while I'm seeing if other folks have commentary that they would like to share, I got the biography that was mentioned on Charles Manson. We're reading Wisdom of Psychopaths right now. That book is not super long. I think we'll probably only have like 4 sessions left, and then we'll I don't even think we'll get to the end of the year, so we'll have to pick another book pretty shortly. People can be thinking the book that was mentioned at the end, it's Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson by Jeff Ginn, where he talks about what factors influence him being so popular and some of that history with regards to these murders provoking whites to think that white genocidal fears that droves of black people were going to come through and kill them and slaughter them, even though white people did this, and charging Geronimo Pratt. If folks would be interested in that, that obviously would be a pretty symmetrical follow-up to the book they were reading right now. I was also thinking of Homegoing. I think that is fiction, but that was very popular, and I know some Cal's listeners suggested that. But be thinking of a text to read next, because Wisdom of Psychopaths is not a long book. If other folks had commentary, feel free. We do not have that much time left in the broadcast. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Now, I did have something written down here in my notes for the week. I haven't gotten a chance to check out the book study session yet, and I do plan on catching up. I have quite a bit catching up to do, but I'm usually working during those hours now. I just wanted to say grandiose delusions. Delusions of grandeur, expansion, expansive delusions, or megalomania are subtype of delusions that occur in patients suffering from a wide range of psychiatric diseases, including two-thirds of patients in a manic state of bipolar disorder, half of those with schizophrenia. Patients with grandiose subtype of delusion disorder and substantial portions of those with substance abuse disorder. Narcissistic personality disorder, or megalomania, exaggerated feelings of self-importance, an excessive need for admiration, a lack of understanding for others' feelings. And along the lines of this narcissistic personality disorder or grandiose delusions disorder, megalomania, they're all the same thing. They cover grandiose delusions disorder, manic, bipolar disorder, dissociative identity disorder, which is multiple personality disorder, schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, psychosis, sociopathy, terminal sexual deviant syndrome. I added that one myself. And this new thing they've added recently, substance use disorder, it's a disorder now to have substance problem. But any of these symptoms, a combination of these symptoms, to me, equals the pathology of every single white supremacist. And if you could take all of them and make the perfect white supremacist, I would say we would have made Charles Manson, one of the greatest white supremacists in the United States history. And in my opinion, he deserves a statue right next to all the rest of the great white supremacists and white supremacy history here, like Ben Tillman, Columbus, Thomas Jefferson, Washington, Hitler, Dillon Stormroof. And I'm going to start calling him three names now, Gus, because he assassinated a public official. And generally, when someone does that, they get the three names, like Lee Harvey Oswald or John Wilkes Booth or James Earl Ray, Osama bin Laden, you know. So I'm going to give him all three of his names. But what I think that I want to say, rest in piss to Charles Manson. And his ability to make other whites, tap into his grandiose delusions and his megalomaniac state is what made him so powerful. To get young white girls with everything to lose to go murder for him. And, he just had a talent for getting white people to do his thing. Last thing I wanted to say is on Thanksgiving, the opposite of thanks is criticism, and the opposite of giving is taking. So I call it criticism for taking day. Should be criticizing white people for everything they've taken from us. But when you type in the acronym for Thanksgiving as a whole word, it comes up with two words, execration and anathema. Execration is the act of cursing, a curse pronounced, imprecation of evil, utter detestation expressed. And anathema is an excommunication with curses, hence a curse or denunciation
by ecclesiastical authority, accompanying an excommunication. The species of excommunication was practiced in ancient churches against notorious offenders. All churches were warned not to receive them. All magistrates and private persons were admonished not to harbor or maintain them, and priests were enjoined not to converse with them or attend their funerals. So Thanksgiving is sounds to me like it's the reversal of a curse put on them by ecclesiastical authorities, and our only people I can think with that authority would be the Catholics. And they were here before the 13 colonies. You have New Spain, you have Louisiana. I mean, all predate that. So we've all who practice Thanksgiving, we all engaged in the grand ritual. I'm quite sure slaughtering the bird was part of the thing. And that was all I had to say, Gus. I'm mute my line. Thank you. Oh, last thing. Oh, Zimbabwe. I just find it very odd. And what rang bells to me was this white girl gets put in jail for a long time by Mugabe. And then maybe two, 3 weeks later, he gets thrown out of office. And that indicated to me who took over the country. I'm mute my line.
Interesting. Context of white supremacy. Folks have any other comments they want to get in before we get ready to wrap things up, you should dial in. Do not wait till the last minute. I hate when people spectate and sit back and they wait until the very end of the program and then decide, oh, yes, I have about 10 things that I want to make sure I get in before we wrap up. You can go ahead and get your hand up now if you think you have a comment, question, anything that you want to share, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943, pound, *61 if you have commentary. And again, we'll be here on Wednesday. We'll have representatives from Black Mamas Matter. This is an alliance that is explicitly about addressing the black maternal mortality rates in this part of the world and providing resources for black mothers to have healthy pregnancies and take care of their children. They'll be here this coming Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in? Last few moments before we get ready to wrap things up. Other caller in Florida, if you had commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Really quick, Gus, I heard only bits and pieces of the audio segment. I think I heard a part where they were talking about LeVar Ball. Was there like a comparison to him and Don King? Was that what they were saying on that? Or I couldn't remember. Was that what they were saying?
That was a part of the segment. Yes, sir. Apparently Donald Trump in a tweet compared LeVar Ball. I think he said he was the poor man's Don King was the way that Donald Trump phrased it.
Oh, wow, wow. Because I know, I noticed Mr. Ball, he's been on the media, and I can see people who classify themselves as white. I know they're not very comfortable about the way that he voices his views and opinions, I think. And I just have a feeling that they're definitely going to start practicing racism toward them if they are not already right now. It looks like they are. I wanted to share something that happened today. I had two conversations with family members, and I think listening to this program, it really helped me out with the not only you guys, but the the people who've made appearances on this program really helped me out with maintaining calmness and using logic to help make a conversation better. And I use that to help these two parties to have a better constructive conversation instead of yelling and being that we have, you know, the toxic within us and we are contaminated. Helped the conversation flow a lot more constructively in regards to the tone and the volume of their voices. They were able to have a way better conversation. So I just wanted to share that. And there was a commercial or ad that I seen. I don't know if anyone's seen this. She might be classified as Asian, you know, a non-white female. And she was at a restaurant and this white man comes in and, you know, they're meeting each other. I guess they may have met online or something. And this white waitress, she comes up and she says, "Wow, like this guy's been here 4 to 5 times this week, all with different women." And the appearance of this white man, just rushed, put together, you know, not well kept, his hair just all over the place, you know. And he was just, and I think she could clearly see that he was appearing this way. And she was just still just immersed and just surprised and just very happy that he was standing in front of her. And the white woman comes up and says, "Oh, well, you know, hey, you know, this guy apparently obviously has been having intercourse with other females, maybe other males." And, you know, she says, "Well, thanks a lot." And then she shakes the white woman's hand and walks out of the restaurant. So I thought that was very interesting. I can't remember what the company was that was on the advertisement. But, yeah, I wanted to share those couple of things. And that's all that I have right now. And thanks.
Spectacular. I'm glad you were able to use some of the techniques to make the conversation go in a more constructive manner. I think that is a big one. I think we had mentioned that earlier on the broadcast about anti-blackness. I think that's, you know, one of the key things, just minimizing that and being able to have more constructive dialogue. It's so easy for things to all of us, just the stress and the frustration, just the toxicity of racism, white supremacy, is so easy for that to head in a non-constructive direction. Talk about that regularly, just paying attention to small cues. What is the volume level? Are people talking really loud and that sort of thing? Just little things that you can do that sometimes can have a big impact. Very glad to hear it. Try to keep things as constructive as you can when being with other non-white people. That is huge, 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 huge. Anytime we can minimize conflict with other black people, making progress. We have other folks, other commentary they want to make sure they got in. Mr. Hey, Steele, you should. Yes, sir, Thomas.
Don King campaigned for Donald Trump, if I'm not mistaken, and used nigger. And he was nigger during the speech, if I'm not mistaken, as well. And to call him a poor man, Don King, I think it shows how unconfused Donald Trump is, because both of them broke into the white man's sport and tried to own their own, and were pretty successful at doing so. And I'm doing my line. Thank you.
Indeed. Was it someone else who spoke up simultaneously who had a comment they wanted to get in?
Real quick.
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Yes, I just wanted to contend with your, I guess, classifying the term spirit in the context that I used it earlier as a metaphor. When I use the word spirit and when the word spirit is used in reference to an organ of an institution, be it, you know, a document or an order or a law or a building or even a revolution, when people say, like, the spirit of a law or the spirit of the Constitution, I think the reference is its intended original purpose by its framers or by its originators or by the institution.
Constitution itself. So, you know, when it said the spirit of the revolution in Zimbabwe, I believe that the intended purpose, I think from what I've read, that the intended purpose of the revolution was the repatriation of lands held on to by colonizers and the elimination of colonial rule within the country or the area known as Rhodesia. So that was my intention in using the word spirit of the revolution. And then also, you know, in reference to some of these people that are making all of these comments about the goings-on in Zimbabwe, I'll also have it be noted that the white supremacists are reporting heavily on China's involvement in the goings-on over there. Again, you're not 100% privy to everything that happened that led up to this transfer of power, but I suspect that the suspected white supremacists that are desiring the return of Rhodesia, I believe they are far behind on their plans of making that happen simply because of the relationships that various African nations have made with the Chinese government. Also, finally, the people that are using Kumbabwe, you know, many of the people that are using this term, I've seen images of them living in the same household as suspected white supremacists. Some of these people even have suspected white supremacists in their families. So, you know, the idea that the Zimbabweans should have or need to be gung-ho or very enthused about, you know, killing or eliminating or further enraging the suspected white supremacists that are already doing everything that they can to sabotage their efforts to have an African, a black nation. You know, I think that just faulting them for not eliminating all of them is or making them further upset, I think it's a bit short-sighted. And if it was as easy as just, you know, let's kill off all the colonizers, and I'm sure that the revolution in Zimbabwe would have done that. So, you know, I just want to register just how bothersome the reaction that many commentators, many victims of racism have here in the United States have reacted to the goings-on all the way over in Zimbabwe. And I will go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
Interesting. Appreciate the explanation with regards to the phrase. Just with that term revolution, that's one. Anytime I hear that in a phrase, I give pause just because that is a term. I don't know if it's in the word God or not, but at least in my experience, that is a term that people use, and there is not consensus about exactly what people mean when they say revolution. And often that's a term people use. I'm not saying you, Mr. Steele, but just many times people use that term and they don't have a definition at all. It's not explicit. It's not detailed. They just say the word revolution, and we all act as though we know what you mean, and we're all using the same definition. That's why I generally give pause, certainly to a spirit like a phrase, spirit of revolution, generally in any context. I'd probably at least have a pause and a question. But thank you for the additional explanation, and certainly for folks, be mindful of the anti-blackness with how the situation in Zimbabwe is being reported, talked about. Certainly. Does anybody have anything they can get in like 30 seconds before we wrap up? We're right at the end. Something you can get in quickly before we conclude.
Follow the logic, not the individual.
Many people are, in their reaction to the goings-on in Zimbabwe, are very upset that the individual, Robert Mugabe, had to be removed or was removed from his position. But the logic behind his removal, study that, study who is now in power, study the reactions of the suspected racists that are writing a number of articles, and study the reactions of suspected racists that are in Zimbabwe themselves. Again, follow the logic, not the individual. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Mr. Steele. We will be here on Wednesday. Black Mamas Matter. We, as I said, we had folks who were asking about lactation counseling, and I think we even had folks who were interested. It was Estat. He called in the beginning of the year, right after I was at the baby shower, black mother having her first child, naturally, no hospital or any of that, breastfeeding as well. And we had folks who were responding. They wanted information for black male doulas, because black dads are important as well, and being involved in the birthing process, all of that goes into the health of the child, health of the family, counter-racist activities. So we'll try and see if we can get some of that information as well for black mothers, black fathers, promoting healthy black children, and see if they have information for folks who happen to be beyond where they are located geographically in this part of the world. But that'll be Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. Looking forward. If you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, complaints, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks for folks tuning in. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I would certainly recommend sobriety. It's still what they call a holiday weekend all the way through. I strongly suspect that there's going to be an increase in enforcement officers out and about on the roads. Be mindful. We are already under attack, terrorism, white supremacy. You do not want to make their job easier by being out and about on this weekend where you are intoxicated and not able to make quality decisions to keep yourself safe, you and anybody that you might be responsible for. You never know when you might bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, any other race soldier, badge or no, when you are behind the wheel. That is as a driver or as a as a passenger. And certainly buckle up. That's one of the easiest things we can do. Help minimize contact with race soldiers. Buckle up every time you are in a vehicle. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest level of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.